Welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff. This week on the show, nothing much happened.
Yeah, there's not like one huge big topic.
No, we could go into politics. The Republicans' healthcare bill fell into flames again, which is straight Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
But I don't know, in stuff we watched, did anything happen, Sean?
Not really. I mean, a little bit of something happened where I have not been able to play that much of it, but the Destiny 2 beta technically launched earlier today, but it launched in the middle of a Tuesday, so I've been too indisposed, but I played through like the mission and the strike, so we could talk about that. But other than that, there's no.
Okay, we should stop playing the new Doctor Who.
What?
We learned the identity this weekend of the 13th Doctor.
What?
Sooner than we thought we were going to.
13?
I had a whole idea about a pre-topic for that. No, we just learned it. It's out there.
What do you mean? I thought Peter Capaldi was playing the Doctor. How can there be multiple people playing this one role on this TV show? That doesn't even make sense, Jonathan.
We will talk about the casting announcement of the 13th Doctor. We will talk about other various pieces of news. We will talk some stuff. We will talk Twin Peaks. But first off.
Yes.
I might sound a little different because my jaw hurts because I got a wisdom tooth yanked out of my mouth.
Congratulations.
We've all in the club. There.
Yeah, I got my wisdom teeth out, like, I think right before I went to college.
Yeah.
And I had pudding, and I played, like, 5 hours of Minecraft while still kind of a little bit high off of some painkillers. And that's about the most Minecraft I ever played in my life. And I feel like I don't ever need to go back to it.
No, I think under nitrous would be the best way to play Minecraft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a very emotional experience.
Now, I had an emergency wisdom tooth pulling, which is that I will probably have to get more pulled out at some point. But I had not had my wisdom teeth out, and one of my wisdom teeth a few years ago had come in seemingly fine, and then I was eating lunch on last Thursday, and it cracked.
Okay.
And that is a freaky feel. It didn't hurt, and the dentist was surprised. I'm like, no, I don't feel anything there. It's fine. But I could run my tooth over and be like, well, this tooth is cracked in half. That's weird, you know?
Yeah.
So I went to the dentist, and he's like, yeah, we're just going to get rid of that because you don't need it, and there's no reason to try to fix it. So, it was a very weird feeling of having the emergency wisdom tooth pulling, but it was fine. They gave me the nitrous. This dentist is the first dentist I've been to in my life who knew what the fuck they were doing, seemingly.
Okay.
And so I'm now less scared of the dentist because I found one who's mildly competent. As I joked to him under the effects of nitrous, but I really meant it, it was the first dentist's office I'd been to that looked like it was up to code. If you just want to know, we have in Golden, Colorado, a lot of seedy dentist offices. So,
I guess I have been lucky. I have not had poor experiences with dentists in a while.
When I was a kid, my parents were cheap. I'm less cheap.
Okay, yeah.
I have insurance.
This is my fucking tooth. Yes. I'm going to deal with this tooth in my own way.
Yes. So anyway, now I got the nitrous. And the whole time, it really worked because I would hear him yanking on it. And all of a sudden, I'd just be like, huh, that's interesting. It was, I don't really do drugs, but that kind of sold me on it, you know?
Great. I mean, that's the whole point. That's really what dentists are here for, is to get you hooked on painkillers.
Exactly. So, anyway, I got that out, and I was a little worried about... Luckily, there was enough space between that and the podcast. A couple days ago, I could not have done this and talked this much. But the most annoying thing is the pudding cups and not eating solid. I'm just now doing some solid foods, mostly pasta, because it's not too solid.
I had a lot of pasta back then, too.
Yeah, so at a certain point... I mean, it's an excuse to eat applesauce as an adult, and I really do like applesauce. But I when I have to ask someone in the grocery store where it is, they pretty much just laugh at me.
Yeah, which is, fair enough. It is a very... You either have to be very young or very old to eat applesauce.
That's a good point.
It's just not a, mid-20s sort of food item.
Indeed. But I got my wisdom tooth out, and I have also... For reasons we'll talk about later, I've been watching the second season of Broadchurch.
Right.
And I wanted to talk about that.
Okay.
Because we talked a lot about the first season when it aired.
Yes.
And, of course, it's written by Chris Chibnall, who's the new Doctor Who showrunner. One of the stars is Jodie Whittaker. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
That's why I kind of wanted to go back. Because I'd watched the first season, and I hold it in high regard. I think it's one of the best TV seasons of the decade.
Yeah.
One of the best acted, one of the deepest, benched casts.
Yeah, just, one of like just the strongest sort of police procedural kind of shows in a while.
Yeah, I think Broadchurch Season 1 is, putting Twin Peaks aside because it's its own weird thing, the best small-town murder mystery thing I've ever seen.
Sure, yeah.
I just think the depth of emotion to which it plumbs those ideas is extreme, and David Tennant and Olivia Colman are geniuses, so you have that. But I had really bounced off the second season when that aired a couple years ago, and I watched like two episodes, and I just bounced off of it and did not give it more of a chance. Had you seen the whole second season?
Yes, yeah. Okay. I watched it around the time when it finished airing, so it's been a little bit for me.
Yeah, and the third season is airing right now on BBC America, so there's also just, I want to catch up, and because the last season has been pretty roundly acclaimed.
Yeah.
So it sounds like they kind of got back onto a better track. And I want to talk about it for a minute because I did finish watching it today. And in fact, I binged the last three episodes. And even Broadchurch Not at Its Best is maybe too emotional an experience to binge that much of it.
Sure, yeah.
Because I came out of that. I drove over here feeling very sad. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the second season of that show is hugely problematic in a ton of ways. I wish I had given it more of a chance at the time because it is still very good.
Yeah, because it's something where it definitely is very flawed, but it is such a more interesting continuation of that show than the, like, another person gets killed in this town and then these characters have to investigate it. I like the idea of it, even if it's not, you know, it's got some issues in how it depicts it. I think that's an interesting idea of saying, like, no, season two is dealing with all the fallout of what happens when a crime happens in this small town is not just you catch the criminal. It's also that criminal was a member of this tiny community, was an important member of this community, and now this community has to deal with the fact that this person who they all loved and trusted committed this horrible crime, and they have to sort of reevaluate their lives in some way.
And on an emotional level, that's the best part of that season.
Yeah.
Because the work Olivia Colman does, dealing with, it was her husband.
Yeah.
Spoiling Broadchurch for you, but whatever.
Yeah, that show was that.
It
was
aired,
a long time ago.
And then it aired again on Fox with David Tennant doing an American accent. Yeah. You've seen it. Well, no one saw that version. But yeah, Olivia Colman dealing with that. The Latimer family with Jodie Whittaker as the mother. And I think especially actually the father in that second season has a really interesting arc.
Yeah.
And just some of the other people in town dealing with that. I think I the trial stuff is atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no justifying how badly written that is. And I think Chris Chibnall is a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
Even in, he can go from writing an awful trial scene to they're back outside the courtroom and it's, you know, Hardy and Miller having just a personal conversation. It's like, this guy's really good at writing character dialogue, which is a good qualification for Doctor Who. So I'm confident he'll do a good job.
Luckily, Doctor Who, not really known for being a courtroom drama.
And thank God, because the whole thing, I'll just summarize the second season of Broadchurch a little bit. The guy who was the culprit in season one, and we all know did it, pleads not guilty, like, as a surprise. And so now there has to be a trial for him. And everyone has to go through this, kind of relitigate the whole thing. And I do think that's an interesting idea. I just think it's done horribly where the courtroom stuff, unless courts in Britain are so alien that they're nothing like in the US, which isn't the case because we based all our court systems off theirs.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like Chris Chibnall doesn't know anything about the law because you have, the thing that annoys me the most is the defense for Joe Miller, the culprit. The woman who plays the defense, she's an okay actress, but it's like her character is just spewing the most bullshit conspiracy theories at everybody in Broadchurch, and the judge never once like says, hey, maybe tone it down when you just put Olivia Colman on the bench and say, were you fucking David Tennant?
Right, yeah.
And so it's like, that would never fly in a court of law, and it's all of it is that stuff, and everything that is predicated on where the case goes by the end of the season is on the most bullshit pandering contrivances that have nothing to do with reality, and that annoys me because I actually think there's a germ of an interesting story in there where the direction I think I would have taken it if I went there is maybe Joe Miller does that, but then watches all these people go through it and then figures out he can't do this to them or something and make him an interesting character in that. Because that also, he's in like every shot of that season because he's in like the defense bench, but he never talks.
Mm-hmm.
And so he never becomes a character in that second season, which is problematic, I think, if you're going to tell that story. But the character stuff is great. There's the side story of season two is David Tennant reopening this cold case that he had that we'd learned about in season one.
Yeah.
And I think most of that is good if needlessly convoluted. Like we got to the finale and like when they reveal how it all happened, I just realized I don't know how these people are related. I don't know who this person is to this person. And there are so many steps in this murder case that I don't know how you would even, like, litigate it. It's ludicrous.
It just felt to me when I watched it, and again, this is going off of, like, old memories now, but, like, I felt like it would have been, they would have better served the show if they had not done that, like, other murder case thing, and instead, like, dedicated that to, like, really fully rounding out just the core courtroom drama and finding other avenues to sort of explore that in a sort of more mature way, I guess.
I agree, because they also have, like, they have the character of the prosecution is played by Charlotte Rampling, who's a phenomenal actress. You know, British acting royalty, and she's good, but her character is so underwritten and just so keeps rolling over and letting awful things happen in this case. And the whole thing is that her character is like this brilliant prosecutor who's come out of retirement because this case is so important, and then apparently she does no homework on it or something. Mm-hmm. Like, and again, I do think you're probably right that those needed to be two separate seasons. I do think the season gets better as it goes along and it finds its footing, and I think some of the interplay between those is important. Part of it is because David Tennant was, you know, his character, Alec Hardy, is not part of this town.
Yeah.
If you don't have that detective case, he's completely, like, detached from the other action of that season. And I do think it's a problem because, you know, he is kind of one of our two main characters. So they have to do something to kind of keep him in play. But, you know, overall, that show still has some of the best cinematography I've ever seen on TV.
Yeah.
Its use of location is outstanding. Its music is utterly outstanding, and so many good performances, it's ridiculous. And they added more people to the cast in season two, and they're all good too. So it's like, that show is ludicrously good, and David Tennant has such a thick Scottish accent, and it is literally one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah.
Like, if we redid our top 100 stuff list, I'm really sad I never put David Tennant's Scottish accent on that, because it is a thing of beauty.
Yeah, it is, like, because when you're so used to the very, like, cleaned up, charming, like, English-accented 10th Doctor David Tennant, getting just, like, the dirty, scruffy, just, like, angry, grouchy Scottish David Tennant of Broadchurch is, it's so nice.
It's so wonderful. It's why I'm excited for the new DuckTales, because he plays Scrooge, and that's awesome. And Olivia Colman, I just think, is one of the best British actresses. I had actually known her from stuff before Broadchurch, and she's so the heart of that show in so many ways. I think Broadchurch is over now because Chris Chibnall has to go do Doctor Who. I want some kind of anthology series where Olivia Colman and David Tennant just team up to do different things. It doesn't have to be fight crimes. They are just so good together.
Sure,
and one of the best things about that show is that it never even leans into a hint of romance between them.
Yeah.
Their chemistry is off the charts, but it's not romantic in the slightest. It's not sexual in the slightest. And that's one of, I think, the most interesting things about that show.
Yeah.
And actually is another thing that, given where Chris Chibnall is taking Doctor Who, I'm glad to see he can write platonic relationships between men and women.
Yes.
Because that's going to be important.
I think it will, yeah.
Yes. What kind of stuff have you been up to, Sean?
A couple of things. I'm deeper into Nier Automata, but I haven't quite finished it yet, so I'll not really talk about it again until I'm done with it next week.
You haven't quite finished it six times yet, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'm very close, but then there's just been too much stuff going on. I was like, I need to... It was one of those things where I got to the point where I was like, I'm going to have like, a solid, like, 5 hours or something to dedicate to just, like, bring this game to an end, because I know I don't want to stop in the middle after I, like, start doing some of this stuff. So I was like, I'm going to wait till I have, like, a good chunk of time to just dedicate to this. So I put it on the back burner for now. But I have finished Season 3 of Hannibal, so I'm done with Hannibal for now. Who knows if they'll bring it back or not. It seems like they're trying to get it.
Do you agree with my assessment, though, that that's a perfect ending?
I mean, yeah. If it's going to stop, it is definitely, like, it's a lot better than if it had gotten canceled after season two. Let's say that. Yeah.
Oh,
it's
but that would be the ballsiest ending of all time.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, if it was, like, the end of season two, you would just assume, oh, I guess all the main characters just died. Okay, yes. I guess that's, except for Hannibal, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like, but everyone else, yeah, I guess they must have all died. It would be a very different ending of the show. But yeah, like, the end of season three, it is a satisfying conclusion, even if it's, like, I so desperately want to see what they would do with
Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, and, like, particularly I just want to see what they would do with Clarice Starling. Like, yeah. I want to see what their take on that character would be. Because I think
it would be
Will
Graham in drag.
Sure.
Yeah. I think there's people are underselling the possibility that they would have Hugh Dancy in drag, and that's how they would do it.
I mean, it's entirely possible, because the other question would be, like, what do they do with Will Graham? Because he, like, the whole show is about his relationship with Hannibal, that, like, obviously, he is not a part of the other stories in the, like, the Hannibal books and stuff.
There's a very sad line in the book Silence of the Lambs where someone says, whatever happened to Will Graham? It's like, he's a drunk down in Florida now. Huh. And he lost everything. It's very dark.
Yeah. But so, yeah, so it's, I would, if they ever do, like, if Netflix or Amazon or someone, like, decides to pick it up and keep on making more Hannibal. I'd be very fascinated to see it continued. But even if it's not, yeah, I think it's a very strong ending. I mean, they managed to... Because I'm not a huge fan of Red Dragon. Like we talked about last time, I like read half of the book and didn't really love it. I don't really like the movie that much either. And so like I've never really liked that story that much. And I think they've managed to make their adaptation of Red Dragon was way more interesting to me than actual Red Dragon. Particularly, I thought like how they changed the ending. It's such a much more interesting ending to that story. That obviously, you need all the background between the characters that they established with the other two seasons to make that ending work. But it's like, the ending is fucking awesome, and how they changed the ending is fucking awesome. Instead of, like, actual Red Dragon, at least based on the movie, I don't know if the book ends the exact same way, but, like, the ending just feels like, it just needs to end, this just needs to stop, so he just stops. We have to write in this conclusion.
The book is so internalized that the book's ending is so much about Will Graham's, like, emotional breakdown.
Okay, yeah.
That, like, I actually think the show mirrors it thematically, if not literally.
Right, but, yeah. But yeah, it's a great show.
Yeah, it's a great show.
People should watch it, yeah.
I didn't ask you this last week. What'd you think of your girl, Gillian Anderson?
She's so fucking good in that.
Isn't she amazing?
She's amazing in everything. And it's something that, like, reminded me, because it's like, you know, she's not in everything all the time, so it's like, I don't always encounter her. And then when she's in something, it's like, oh, right, I forgot I'm 100% completely in love with Gillian Anderson, and I had forgotten that. And then I see her for 1 second, I'm like, right! Like, ever since I was, like, 8 years old or something watching The X-Files, I've been in love with this woman. And she's still fucking amazing. And I still am.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she gets... I mean, she's the best part of the third season. Yeah. She's in it so much. She's so good.
Like, there's part of you that feels like if they kept on making Hannibal, like, the TV show, and then eventually, like, presumably, like, the last season or something would be, like... their own unique story, original story again, and not based on any of the books. I think, like, how that would end, it would have to end with Gillian Anderson killing and eating Hannibal, right?
Yes.
Like, that's the way that series would have to end. That's the only way it could go. Because she's, like, the one character that feels like she actually, like, is able to kind of one-up Hannibal in her own, like, really kind of, like, crazy way. She's awesome.
She's so good. She gets the last shot of the show.
Yeah.
Which is a hell of a shot. Oh, man. If you haven't seen Hannibal, we're dancing around the edges.
Yeah. No, it's a great show.
Yeah. Anything else?
Well, like I alluded to earlier, I played some of the Destiny 2 beta. Like, it's hard to... Because it was something where I, like, have tried to just cram in as much as it possible before you came over. Because, again, it came out... This is only if you have pre-ordered it. You have, like, a couple of days early access on the PS4 version. There's going to be a full open beta access to everyone in a couple of days. I don't remember specifically when... But so because it, like, opened up in the middle of a Tuesday, I was like, well, I can't play it right now because I had other stuff I was doing. And so there's like, okay, I've got like 90 minutes. Let's see how much of this I can play. And I've got a good amount in, like, so basically what they have made available is very similar from what I understand of what people have seen from the Destiny 2 reveal event and from, like, the E3 demos they did. It is not like the Destiny 1 alpha or beta where that was just like, the beginning of Destiny, and it was like, here's like level 1 through 8 and like 3 story missions in one strike, and it's just Destiny. We just stop how far you can get. This is you, when you load it up, you like make your character, which you don't actually make a character, you just pick whether you're going to be the Hunter, Titan, or Warlock. You don't get to like do character customization, so they just kind of give you this pre-made character. You load into what I presume is the first mission from the game, which is what they showed at the Destiny 2 reveal event, and then once you beat that, you can play, there's like 2 multiplayer modes, and I only played 1 multiplayer match, and I liked it, but I didn't get to play enough to sort of like give a full opinion on that. But then you can play the one strike that they had already shown. So you don't get to see any of like what a patrol missions are like in New Destiny. You don't even get gear. Like that's like, so you do not drop new gear in the missions. They like kind of give you some at some like select intervals if you beat like the strike and stuff like that. You don't level up, you don't get experience, so all those features of the game are blocked off from you, so it's kind of hard to give a fuller impression of what Destiny 2 is going to be like when you get the full release. But based on what I have played, I really, really like it a lot. It is the core of the combat and all of that stuff is Destiny, like it is definitely that, but it is refined in a really powerful way, and I think the mission design of like that first mission and the strike are like 2 of the best Destiny missions I've played. So like if
that's a good sign.
Yeah, if that quality maintains, like I think Destiny 2 is going to be really, really good. So for some of the, to sort of like speak to some of the things they've changed, the big things are, because we've talked about this on like the Destiny 2 reveal stream or reveal podcast that we did. So there's no like huge new information that had been revealed with this beta, but it's like the way they handled weapons is different now. So instead of having like a primary weapon, which would be like a assault rifle, secondary weapon, which would be like a shotgun, and a power weapon, which would be like a rocket launcher, it's broken down into kinetic weapons and energy weapons, which are the weapon pools between those two types are shared between like, you know, auto rifles, scout light rifles, pulse rifles, sidearms, all those kinds of ones. And like then like shove submachine guns, which is one of the new ones. And it's just determined by whether or not it does like kinetic ballistic damage or whether or not it does energy damage. And that's what determines if it goes into one of those two slots. And then you have like the special or like power weapon slot, which all the old like shotgun, sniper rifle, fusion rifle, those are then grouped in there with like the rocket launcher and grenade launcher and stuff. And at first, when I first played through the mission, because I played it as a hunter, and then like I very quickly just kind of like blazed through the first mission as the warlock and the titan to just see what their abilities were. But I'll kind of like talk about the hunter stuff. The first time I played through that the first mission, I didn't really like the way the weapons were set up because I felt like I didn't quite understand like which ones should I have in which slot and how should I use them and switch between them. But when I played the strike and then like went through the mission, the first mission again very quickly with the titan and the warlock, I really like that setup now. Once I got a feeling for like, okay, I can put like a hand cannon or an auto or like a scout rifle here, and then have, you know, a submachine gun or an auto rifle here, and it allows you to sort of like make better use of the different sort of like variations of each of the different types of guns, because, you know, like you have a scout rifle that could be like a really long range and very slow firing, or you could also have a scout rifle that had like actually you can fire as fast as you can pull the trigger and is more suited for closer range encounters. And some of those like those guns that are on like the edge of their sort of usability of like the scout rifle that's practically a sniper rifle, or like the auto rifle that's like practically like just a like a vomit of bullets onto your enemies and you have to reload immediately, that's only suited for extremely close range. Those guns kind of existed in Destiny 1, but they were never useful, right? Because you wanted the gun that was most applicable for like the most different combat scenarios. And here you can really make use of like the whole variety of the different types of weapons, because you can put one in your primary and one in your energy weapon slot.
Yeah, I love the idea of this, because yeah, it really sounds like it. You know what it weirdly reminds me of? And it's a very different system, but it reminds me of when, like, Call of Duty for perks went to the pick 10 thing.
Yeah.
Of, like, instead of making it all tiered, just, like, have the boxes and let people kind of fill it with what they want. And it doesn't unbalance the game. It actually allows you to really, like, specify, like, okay, yeah, I find this useful, let me put it here. Because you're right, there is, with, like, main weapons in Destiny 1... you could switch between them, but it was cumbersome to go into the menu. And so, yeah, I really almost exclusively use scout rifles there, or whatever, you know, if I had a better of something else, maybe. But I like the auto rifles. I like the fusion rifles. I like all of these. And I like the idea of being able to maybe, you know, pick and choose a little more.
Yeah.
So I should say I haven't played the beta yet. I have not pre-ordered the game yet, and B, I forgot it was happening.
Right, yeah.
So I will have played it by next week, I'm sure, because there's going to be the open beta. But...
yeah, so that I think is a good change. It also means that you use your power weapon a lot more frequently, because before it was like once a mission you would pop out your rocket launcher and be like, okay, now I'll like blow up this big enemy with my rocket launcher, and then you're never going to see like purple ammo again for like the whole mission. And here like the ammo, the purple ammo type drops more frequently, and then like there's something nice about being like, it's not just a rocket launcher or a heavy machine gun, or I guess eventually they added the sword to that slot in Destiny 1. Now it's like you actually have a nice variety of weapons, which I should like note, like one of the things the beta does is you drop into the mission with like, I believe, a more or less random assortment of weapons. Like they just give you like, here's like 5 kinetic weapons, 5 energy weapons, and like 3 power weapons, and you can just use what you want, because again, they don't drop gear. So it's just like, here's like a bunch of hand cannons and just assault rifles and random shit, just put them where you want and use them. And so that's like nice, because you can just quickly try all these things out. And I like the feeling of like when you pull out a shotgun now, the shotgun is so fucking powerful and ridiculous because they've moved it to that last slot, that just feels like, okay, now I'm going to pull this fucking shotgun. I'm going to get up close and we're going to get some real business done. And it's a very nice feeling. And I like how like those weapons have been very powered up to fit into that new slot. And then that goes into the other, and I think probably the most significant change to the game, is actually how subclasses work. So if you remember in Destiny 1, you know, you have the whole system of, like, you know, you're a hunter, which is your, like, top-level class, and then you could pick, like, be a gunslinger or a blade dancer or whatever, like, the new one they added in Tank King was. And then, so you, if you're a gunslinger, then you go in, and that's what determines what your double jump is, what your grenade type is, what your melee is. And then there's, like, a number of different sort of, like, perks that were, like, oh, this makes it so your golden gun super, like, penetrates targets. This one makes it so if you get, like, headshots, you can reload faster for 5 seconds or something. And you had all of those, and it was, like, this weird kind of grid arranged with, like, where you could, like, pick from, like, the vertical column, and they were arranged horizontally. And so you had, you know, three options in the, like, a golden gun modification one that you could just pick between. And that's how the subclasses worked in Destiny 1. In Destiny 2... it's a really interesting setup where you still get to pick what your grenade type is and what your double jump is, and then you also have two options for this new ability all the classes have of, like, the hunter has a roll they can do that you can either make it so that the roll recharges your melee attack or it reloads your gun. The Titan has a shield they can pop down that can either be this big shield that will, like will last a long time, or a smaller shield but that you can duck behind and shoot over. And then the Warlock has, like, this area of effect thing that they can put down this kind of circle on the map that if you stand within, you'll either be healed or you can make it so that it'll increase the amount of damage you do. So you have those abilities that each of the classes have, but that's another thing you can pick between. But other than that, all the old, like, kind of, like, perk-style ones that would be, like, oh, this makes your golden gun do this or this does that, those are all, like, put together into, like, this diamond of four abilities that just come as, like, a package. And they only have one that is unlocked for each of the subclasses, and you can see another one. So I don't know if there's going to be more than two, and they're just kind of, like, letting you know that eventually in the full game you're going to be able to pick between these, or if, like, there's only going to be two, who knows. But basically it means that, so for the beta, you just kind of, like, get this one sort of version of the subclass that you don't get to sort of customize as heavily as the Destiny 1 subclasses were. And at first, I was very resistant to that. But especially once I sort of was able to go through with the Warlock and the Titan and see how all those subclasses work, because you can, each of the classes have two unlocked in the beta, and I think there's going to be three or maybe four in the full game. You get this good sense of how, by taking away some of that customization, they've managed to make the abilities, I think, more that you have more interesting, and they synergize much more effectively. And then also it helps make the PvP feel way more balanced, at least based on the one match I played. And so I actually think it makes it so that all the subclasses have a much more, like, defined sort of identity, and the abilities you have link together in really interesting ways to sort of, like, really effectively change the way you're actually playing that class. And so to sort of give an example, my favorite one for the Hunter was the new class they had that's kind of, like, looks like the Blade Dancer because it's, like, the electric type one, but it has, like, the abilities are completely different. And that one has the four abilities you have all kind of work together to really heavily emphasize you using your melee attack. So it's stuff of, like, if you do your dodge roll, it will make it so that your melee attack has, like, a greater distance. And then also now, like, your melee attack, if you do your melee attack when it's fully charged, it then unlocks this period for, like, 5 seconds or something where you can do the fully powered up melee attack multiple times in a row. And I think it's, like, if you get a kill with a melee attack, it increases the ability or the rate at which your dodge ability recharges. So all those things work together to make it so that when that class is really well suited for getting in close, like rolling up in front of an enemy, beating the shit out of them and, like, rolling out of the way and having, like, the kind of melee chains that's really interesting. And all the other classes have things like that of, like, one of the Warlock classes have all the abilities around being able to take enemies out while you're gliding in the air that will, like, recharge your grenade powers and stuff like that. And so all the subclasses are now designed around this sort of philosophy of having these synergistic abilities that all work together instead of you having this, like, weird patchwork quilt of, like, oh, I'm going to, like, kind of take this with, like, the throwing knife. I'm going to kind of, like, make my golden gun do this cool thing. And that had its charm in Destiny 1, but I think the way they're doing it in Destiny 2 is, one, it's way less confusing, and two, it feels like they've managed to sort of balance the game around this sort of core idea to make the classes feel more interesting to play for me.
It definitely sounds like they've pinpointed the messier aspects of Destiny 1 and kind of gone in with, you know, surgical precision, in so much as they're not giant, obvious surface changes, but they're very good refinements, is my sense.
Yeah.
Even though I haven't played it. But
no, I think that's a good way of looking at it, that it definitely feels like they have figured out what worked about Destiny 1 and what did not work as much about some of that stuff with Destiny 1, to say, like, okay, like, how do we refine this? How do we make this more simple, but then also in simplifying it, like, I think, make the combat more rewarding in a lot of ways by making it so that your weapon choices feel like you're using all three of your weapons more frequently, and then also making it feel like your abilities for your class are not just like a hodgepodge. They all work together and sort of like synergize together.
And of course, there's a lot more we'll have to see when the game actually launches, because a lot of Destiny's issues are more systemic, large-scale things.
Yeah, that's kind of, for me, I'm a bit disappointed that they didn't have any of that stuff in the beta, because that's the stuff I was most interested to see, like, get my hands on. What is the core loop of Destiny 2 going to be? Is it going to be any different? But, you know, I think this beta, like, it's definitely... I would not say you need to, like, go out of your way to right now to, like, go do a pre-order on Amazon to get a code to get in extra early, because there's not... Again, there's, like, one story mission, one strike, and then two multiplayer modes. There's not... You don't need to rush to get into the beta to be able to make sure you have enough time to play it all. But once it goes open for everybody, I think it, like, check it out. It's cool. It's fun. Like, and do the thing of going through and playing through that first mission with all the three classes, because the way they've changed all of them is really interesting, and it's fun to see all the different powers.
That was the best thing about the Destiny beta the first time around, was getting a feeling for the classes so that when the game launched, you're like, I know what I'm going to play.
Yeah, there's definitely, like, it is one of those things where you play... I started with the Hunter, obviously, because that was the one I played the most in Destiny. But then when I went through with the Warlock and the Titan, I was like, fuck, they're all so much fun to play, and they all feel so different. And, like, some of the new supers, like, the Titan has this super that is so fucking awesome, where it's the new class called, like, the Sentinel or something. It's their Void class. And the super is you get, like, this... like, summon this, like, purple Captain America kind of shield.
Oh,
and you can
either...
And this is something they've changed for, like, almost all of the supers in the game are like this now. Of that, it's, like, it's not just you, like, throwing out, like, oh, I'm going to do a big ground pound and that's it. It's more like those ones in Destiny 1 that were, like, oh, I'm kind of, like, transformed into, like, this, like, lightning sword mode or whatever, or, like, hammer throwy mode for the Titan. And, like, I have actually, like, kind of a couple of things I can do with this while I'm in super state instead of it just being a big attack. And so, like, when you summon that Captain America shield, you can either run around and, like, just kind of hit people with it, you can throw it, or if you hold down L2, it, like, projects a shield around you that you could use to, like, defend your other enemy or your other teammates. And so the supers are a little bit more versatile in that way, and that's
awesome.
Fun.
Yeah, Titan was kind of wound up being my main by the end of Destiny 1.
I think you will like what they have done with the Titan.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it's good.
All right, you want to talk some news?
Let's talk some news.
All right, normally we would go through all the little news before we get through the big news, but I don't want to wait.
Well, what happened in the news? I feel like we talked about something earlier, but...
Doctor Who!
Oh, right! They've recast Doctor Who. That's a weird move.
All right, so it's time. We know who the new Doctor is. They announced on was it Saturday or Sunday?
I think it was Saturday.
It was Saturday, because it was at the end of Wimbledon on the BBC.
Wimbledon's done. The sport's over.
Yeah. At the end, yeah.
They decided it's like with the female Doctor Who, we can't have Wimbledon anymore in this world.
Anyway, they aired a little one-minute trailer. I actually liked this more than the last time they announced the Doctor, and it was a 30-minute special.
Was like the only thing relevant was like the 8-minute interview with Peter Capaldi at the end.
Yes, I liked the 1-minute, really, I think, nicely done little trailer. And we learned that our new Doctor for the next season of Doctor Who, which again will be run by Chris Chibnall, Stephen Moffat's leaving, Peter Capaldi's leaving, will be Jodie Whittaker.
Yes.
Who we have experience with from Broadchurch.
Yes, she is the mom in Broadchurch.
And she is phenomenal in it.
Yes.
And she's been in other things. I have not seen some of her other work. I know she was also in the movie Attack the Block, which is very acclaimed. John Boyega, who's in the new Star Wars movies, got his start there. But Jodie Whittaker is the 13th Doctor. And this is significant for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, the most basic thing to say is that, hey, they cast a phenomenal actor as Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I feel good.
Yes.
Right? Like, that's the number one thing.
They didn't do, like, the thing I've always feared, which is, like, they cast a 23-year-old supermodel because they're, like, really famous in this, like, 1 second to be Doctor Who. It's like, you finally did it, BBC, you killed the show. No, they're like, we're going to get a proper actor.
Yes. And Jodie Whittaker is nothing if not a proper actor. And, also an actress, if we're using gendered terms. And, of course, that is important because the Doctor has always been a Time Lord, not a Time Lady.
Yes.
But Peter Capaldi, this Christmas, will be turning into a Time Lady, and that will be interesting.
Yeah, it's a really huge moment for the history of the show, for sure. I mean, technically, we had a female doctor in Curse of the Fatal Death, and technically there's a spin-off like Elseworlds kind of like alternate universe story in a Big Finish audio with a female Doctor Who, and that was pretty good. So technically there have been women who've played the Doctor, but not in
the main continuity of Doctor Who.
Not in whatever the fuck the main continuity of Doctor Who is, but yes, the official like TV show televised version of Doctor Who, there has not been a woman who played the Doctor.
Indeed. And this is cool, you know. Tweeted the night. I really did want, before this announcement came down the pike and it just happened very suddenly, I would love to have had a conversation between you and me on the hypothetical of should the next Doctor be a woman.
Yeah, because I feel like we talked about that when Matt Smith regenerated a little bit. We haven't revisited the topic since, I don't think.
So let's talk about it a little bit. Obviously, it's happened, so, and we're both happy about it.
Yeah.
It was an evolution for me. Not that I ever like was against it on principle.
Yeah.
It was just that I think when that not that the idea was first kicked around Matt Smith's regeneration, just that
it's been
started
around for a long time.
Yes, just that it got a zeitgeist, I think, on the internet around then. My thought was not that's a bad idea. My thought was that's a complex thing to do, and I don't know if the show's equipped to do it.
Yeah, at that moment.
But the thing is, I really have come around on that. I think that was a failure of imagination on my part, and I think a failure of imagination on many people's parts at the time. Not that I don't think they should have cast Peter Capaldi, because he's fucking amazing and all that, and I would never want to live in a world where he didn't get to play the Doctor. But I do think it was just a failure of imagination saying, yeah, the things that define the Doctor are so not tied to gender that it would be a massive missed opportunity not to let the Doctor make that big change and say, throw gender out the window, throw that thing we've associated with the Doctor out the window. And to me, it's like, now you can get to a different part of the heart of the character.
Yeah.
In addition to, you open up the casting pool, and now it's like, okay, there are different kinds of performers who get to play the Doctor, and now we get someone like Jodie Whittaker, who in our past ways of thinking would not have gotten to play this part. It's exciting that we will get to see someone like Jodie Whittaker play this part.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where I've come down on it, and I'm so glad they made this decision for so many reasons. Again, boiling down to, I just think she's a really good performer, and even though the Broadchurch part is in no way a Doctor Who-esque role, it clearly shows she has the acting chops for, I think, a lot of what you could throw at her on this show, and I'm excited to see other sides of her, because she doesn't get to smile much on Broadchurch or have fun. And I assume she can do those things, and the Doctor is a fun part to play. So that's going to be cool, too.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, while like I've always been open to the idea of a woman playing Doctor Who, and I don't think it would have been some disaster or something if that had happened when Matt Smith regenerated, I still do think that like at that moment in time, I think like with Stephen Moffat still running the show, and with like after season 7 being like one of, if not the worst season of new Doctor Who, I think like Peter Capaldi was the right choice for the right time of like bringing the show back to this like basic of the character and do this like core of the show and like getting that Peter Capaldi era that I think like now, like if they had not gone for someone who isn't a white dude, it would have been a really bad choice because I think there's one of the things that you have to do with Doctor Who, I think always, is cast the new Doctor against the old Doctor. And I think Peter Capaldi was, like, the perfect person against Matt Smith, of, like, Matt Smith being very youthful. I mean, obviously his performance of the Doctor had, like, that age to it. But on the outside, very youthful, like, and he was a young actor, and then going to, and he was, like, bubbly and fun and quirky and eccentric, and then going to Peter Capaldi, who is, like, was much older, and, like, this much more experienced actor that brought this, like, certain kind of gravitas and, like, severity to the role that, like, went back to like a William Hartnell or John Pertwee version of the Doctor, and feels like that has like was the right decision to sort of like bring that era to an end and to a close, and like because it really like, and also him leaving with Stephen Moffat feels like it's the appropriate thing to do to just like bring that whole arc from the beginning of from 2005 of the beginning of the revived series and the Doctor starting in this like very damaged time war, like whatever, like how do we get Doctor Who to come back and make it work, and like in modern television, and they made all these changes with the time war and giving him PTSD and all these things that worked for a character thing then, that then it feels like over the course of Stephen Moffat's run, we have like by the time we get to the end of Peter Capaldi, I feel like that has so come to an end that like we had the 50th anniversary, resolved the Gallifrey stuff, the Doctor went back to Gallifrey in season 9, like all of that stuff is like done, and you can just have the Doctor be the Doctor again in a way that has not been true for the entire run of new Doctor Who. And now it feels like that has, that putting that to an end means like now we need to like wipe the slate clean and like start new, start fresh, and start with an actor that is not a white guy. Because because I don't know how else you would cast against Peter Capaldi. Like, you'd have to like get Matt Smith again or something. Like, you'd have to cast against him backwards, and that's not the way to do it. You have to cast against him going forward, and getting an actress like Jodie Whittaker, I think, is the right choice to do to make that.
Oh, it's so perfect. I think Peter Capaldi, to me, is kind of the definitive version of this type of doctor.
Yeah.
Of the older, world-weary, you know, but still very energetic kind of doctor. I think he has put such a stamp on the part as we know it, that if you went with... I kind of don't care who the white guy is, any white guy on Earth, even actors I love, I don't know how that would work. I don't know how you could step into those shoes and make it an interesting next step. It had to be something different, and I think going female at this point is perfect. And I think it's also worth saying, talking about the arc of the show up to now, the groundwork Moffat and Capaldi, and especially Michelle Gomez, laid in these last 3 years to, I think, help open viewers' minds and the mind of the show to how gender works with regeneration in these things and lay that groundwork. One, I think it allows Chris Chibnall to kind of hit the ground running with this, because you don't need to do any of the awkward kind of talking around it. You can just go with it. And I really think it did help, like, seeing Michelle Gomez play the Master and seeing how ultimately, like, the gender is not what makes that so different and interesting. Yeah. It's that she is as much of a, you know, scary, interesting, diverse Master as any of them have been. And then her becoming a Time Lady instead of a Time Lord is this interesting thing on top of it. And then I think they've done a good job continuing to talk about those issues, especially in Series 10.
Yeah, especially by having her with the John Sim Master and being like, they're the same fucking character, and you can just see that and feel that in the TV show.
Yes,
and
I mean,
you can see that as long as it's not written, like, as long as an idiot's not fucking writing it, which has always been my fear of, like, some fucking idiot's gonna get their hands on this and, like, do the worst, sexiest, like, sexist bullshit version of that, which is still a possibility. And I, please, like, God, like Chris Chibnall had, like, make sure that none of that shit slips through the cracks, because that's always a fear.
Here's the test.
Yeah.
Don't give her a pink sonic screwdriver. Right, if you've done that, you fucked up.
Yeah. So, but, like, as long as an idiot is not writing it, like, not a sexist piece of shit, like, you can clearly see that, yes, you can just make that work, and you can have Missy and you can have the John Sim Master on screen together, and it is no different than having David Tennant and Matt Smith on screen together. Like, you buy those two people are the same character as much as it, as any other time in the history of the
and
show.
And I think what that story material, especially in Series 10 and in that two-part finale, sold for me is what a creative opportunity this is.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what I had thought the whole time, is if I was Chris Chibnall stepping into this, there's nothing I would want to do other than write a female doctor, because what an opportunity that is to say, you know, especially I think in the zeitgeist we are in right now, when so many of these issues are in politics and in culture, and say, gender is not the thing that defines this character, and how do characteristics extend beyond the physical form, and those sorts of ideas, like you almost get in Wachowski sibling movies.
Sure.
I guess they're the Wachowski sisters now.
Yeah.
That you get in some of their later work. Like, those kind of things are so interesting to me, and to try to take this, the Doctor, who has been, you know, for 53 years a male character, and go in that new direction with it, that just, it's a huge creative opportunity. And it's exciting and probably a little daunting because, yeah, it's a minefield of things you could fuck up.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, especially with the right actress in play, and they've gotten the right actress, I think that's an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, Stephen Moffat has given interviews where he said, no, I had no idea who they were casting. Shut up, Stephen. You obviously knew what Chris... Like, maybe you didn't know the exact person.
Yeah.
Chris told you he was going to cast a woman, because that's so late baked into, I feel like, some of the final episodes of Series 10.
Sure, yeah.
Like, the whole line about the future is female and the Doctor's thing about how we don't see gender. Like, there's just enough of that that it's like, I think the groundwork was being laid. And I'm glad it was.
Yeah.
I think it's good diegetic things to have in there that will make the transition feel even smoother. But yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, there were interesting interviews with all the players. Chris Chibnall did come out and say, this was always my plan. And I'd read an interview with Chibnall a few months ago where he said the BBC had asked him a couple times to take over the show. And he'd said, like, while they were looking for a replacement. And he'd said no a few times, thinking he didn't want to do it. And then finally he said, okay, there's something I want to do with Doctor Who that we've never done before. If you let me do that, I'll do the show. And he didn't say what it was. I kind of assumed it was this.
Yeah.
And now we kind of know that's what it is. So he's clearly going into this with a vision and not a whim, you know, and I think that's important to be committed to it. And then I just have to say, like, when you saw Jodie Whittaker take the hood down in the little trailer, and you know, we see like a full shot of her for the first time as the Doctor, even though it's obviously not her final costume or anything, I just thought, she really looks like the Doctor. Yeah. There was just something about it. And I think if I had just seen a, you know, something from her on Broadchurch where she's playing such a down-to-earth human character, I wouldn't have thought that from that, like, physicality level that, you know, kind of... And it's so much in how an actor carries themselves that makes them the Doctor.
Yeah.
You know, because David Tennant on Broadchurch also doesn't look like the Doctor, in part because he's scruffy and drunk and...
Man, but if you, like, if they finally gave the fans what they wanted and recast David Tennant somehow as the Doctor in the future, but it was, like... gruff, grumpy, Scottish, Broadchurch-style David Tennant, and he gave, like, a Peter Capaldi-style performance, maybe that would be pretty good.
Okay, I drafted this tweet and didn't send it. My joke was going to be, I know he's already been the Doctor, but now I really want David Tennant to play a companion who is, like, the grandchild of Jamie from the second Doctor.
Yeah.
And he's just Scottish and bitter.
Yes, yeah.
Kind of different than Jamie, who was Scottish and happy.
Yeah.
Yes, but no. But I just, yeah, what I was saying is in that one-minute trailer... I was like, oh man, she really looks like the Doctor to me, and there's just something about that, and I'm a 24-year-old white guy.
Yeah.
There's got to be a lot of, I think, Doctor Who fans, women of all ages, but also little girls who watch the show, and that had to be a cool moment.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is absolutely the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then it leads to, let's, like, speculate about some stuff, because it leads to, for me, the biggest question is, do they decide let's do a male companion? Like, do we still do, like, 20-something woman living in London as the companion till the end of time? Like, does that change that side of the show? I think there are a lot of, like, questions, other, like, supplementary questions about, like, does this lead to other changes in what we do?
Yeah, and I do think those are some of the biggest unanswered questions. Because I think at the end of the day, I can so easily kind of see in my mind the transition and the regeneration and her picking up that mantle and running with it.
Yeah.
But it is the things around it that are the question marks, particularly the issue of companion. And this is a hard one right now because Moffat is doing what Russell T. Davies did all those years ago, and he's just cleaning deck. Like,
yeah.
Chibnall is going to start with something akin to the 11th Hour, I'm thinking, or Spearhead from Space, where he's going to have to start very fresh.
Yeah.
And I think that will be hard when you have to answer a lot of these questions, although it's also possibly a good opportunity. The first thing that came to my mind, I will admit, is I wish Nardole were left in a narrative position to be around.
Sure.
Because there's something about he's just such a steady presence who I can imagine with any doctor that would be... You always want some degree of continuity when you switch doctors, unless, again, like Spirit from Space, 11th Hour, you're operating at a really high bar.
Yeah.
You know, I think that generally helps. But no, I'm actually interested to hear your thoughts on this because I'm undecided. I think they could go with a female companion and it wouldn't bother me in the slightest. I think they could try a male companion, which is not new for Doctor Who, but is rarer.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting. But what do you think?
Yeah, like, it's something where, I mean, number one, make this extremely fucking clear. No romance. Under no fucking circumstances. That does not change. That absolutely does not fucking change just because the Doctor's a woman.
Yeah, and we're not new to that. We thought that about the
David I have Tennant. Always fucking yes. thought that.
Yes.
The only time it was a success or it was acceptable was in the first Doctor story, The Aztecs, and that's it.
What happens in The Aztecs?
He has a very nice sort of relationship with an Aztec older woman, and it's very beautiful, and it's, yeah.
I can see that.
It's very nice. It's very tastefully done. Other than that, because she's his true love, and so it's, you know, he's been pining after her for 2,000 years or whatever, but yeah, it's never been a thing that made sense. Like, I think they did a good job with, like, the River Song character, but River Song is not a companion, not by my fucking definition. And two, she's not a human. Like, she's not a proper normal human. It's just the idea of trying to sort of sell this relationship between this 2,000-year-old fucking, like, basically god of time at this point, and this 20-year-old woman who, like, works in a shop in London. It's never fucking worked for me. It did not. Like, I think that I tolerated Rose for as long as I could tolerate Rose, and I think for a while they did a good job by that relationship, and then by the end of season two, you saw why. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do that. So, yeah, it's never been a good idea. I think it's doubly not a good idea to try to, like, do it with a female doctor because for obvious fucking reasons.
Yeah, and I think Chris Chibnall is smart enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, knowing just that unless something radical happens in the third season of Broadchurch, he can keep a handle on platonic relationships between men and women not give into what every other TV show on Earth with a male and female co-leads has done. Like, I think he probably has the self-control not to go, oh, girl doctor, romance.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Again, but it's always been one of the, when I've thought about this idea, it's been one of the many fears of, like, when they do, it's an ideal world, there would be no issue with it. It's just when you think about what, like, if you think about, you know, when, in, like, the dark periods of Doctor Who in, like, the 80s, when you have, like, Michael Grade from the BBC with his fucking grubby hands all over the show, if, like, someone like that in, like, a production capacity of the BBC was like, no, we're going to, like, force this in, that's always been my greatest fear with this kind of thing on the show, and I definitely don't think it's going to happen this time.
The BBC likes Doctor Who.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly.
It's a big difference.
They're not, like, bizarrely trying to fucking destroy it like they once did. But so, anyways, with, like, the whole romance thing aside, that, like, that is not something I'm interested in them exploring. I do think this is, like, because it is both, changing the Doctor into a woman both gives you, like, this creative opportunity to explore that space. But I think it also opens up that door for, like, we can have it, like, if you're still going to do a solo companion, you can have a solo male companion, which has basically never been done. Like, the closest is, like, Steven in the first Doctor era, kind of, but that was only in, like, briefest moments in between serials, basically, when they're switching the female companion.
And Jamie was the consistent second Doctor's companion, but there were always others,
right? Yeah, but there were always others, yeah. I don't think there was ever an adventure where it was only Jamie and the second Doctor. There might have been, like, one or two that, and those would have been lost.
Because I will say, my other instinct is that I think a group dynamic would be an interesting thing to explore again, in part because I'm always for that on Doctor Who, and I generally like that. You know, hey, this would be a great time to bring Susan back. And the Doctor's being like, Susan, a lot has happened. I've gone through a lot of regenerations.
Yeah, I have gone through all my regenerations, and I'm, like, started in on my second set.
And then I think you want Susan to be like, and only now you turned into a woman? That's sexist, Doctor.
Sure.
No, I'm kidding.
No.
But, yeah, and then... Anyway, what were you going to say?
But yeah, so yeah, I think, like, you know, the group dynamic thing is always a possibility, in which case I would presume the group would be mixed gender, unless, like, there'd be a crazy, like, Sisterhood of the Traveling TARDIS or something that you could do. It was just, like, this group of, like, five women going around space. Like, maybe that would actually be kind of amazing.
That would be absolutely amazing.
Yeah. But, like, I think if you're still going to do the single companion thing... I think, like, it would be a shame not to take that opportunity where, like, because I think for obvious reasons, like, if it was, you know, a male doctor and then having a male companion, like, one, like, that would just, like, completely cut out, like, the female role in the show entirely. So for, like, that reason, it would have been bad. But it's, like, I think it's just, like, also that dynamic wouldn't that always be that interesting where it's, like, here, I think, like, there's this opens up this opportunity to be, like, hey, we can have this, like, male presence in the show that is in a very different capacity, a very different role, and explore that space. And it allows you to just, like, again, have a companion that's not this, like, 20-something woman just from London. Like, even if it has to be a 20-something man from London, it's a slight difference, you know?
Yes.
I mean, at least with, like, Bill was gay, Bill was black, and she was working class, so it's, like, it wasn't the same mold as, like, 80% of all Doctor Who companions, but yeah. Or we can finally, you know, let's go back to when we could have aliens as the companion for the Doctor, or, like, robots, you know, like Chameleon for, like, the two episodes he's in.
I think, you know, just really throw Jodie Whittaker through the gauntlet, and her only companion next season is K-9, and she has to act opposite the dog all year.
Okay, yeah, I would be up for that. Modern K-9, but it's still, like, the same crappy, like, dog thing. It's not a CGI.
I want K-9 back one way or another.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be on its own, but maybe, I do want K-9 back.
Maybe she just finally makes a K-10.
Yes.
Like, I've been just doing new remodels of the K-9 unit. Let's, like, upgrade you, make you K-10.
Yes. So what other things about the show? I the companion thing is just going to be hard to see where they're going with it until, you know, we see an announcement.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen Moffat's run, he was not at all opposed to the group thing because there's two seasons of Matt Smith that have both Rory and Amy.
Yeah.
And then you have season 10, which is 12 and Nardole and Bill.
Yeah.
So although Nardole isn't always there, he is ultimately, I think you would define him as a companion.
Yeah, I would, yeah. I mean, he's in the opening credits.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah. So we'll see what they do with it. I mean, it's just, everything's going to change because it's a new showrunner, new actor, new people behind the scenes. I hope Murray Gold stays on because he's such a great composer. And I want to hear him take on another Doctor and see how many great Doctor themes he can write.
Exactly.
Because he's done like four so far.
Yeah.
And they're amazing. So... What else would we say for...
I want them to keep the TARDIS set the same.
I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you can maybe, like, add some bits and bobbles and evolve it a little bit. But, you know, I don't want them to have this thing that they've been going on that's like, you have to change it all the fucking time. Where it's like, back in the old days, Like, it... I mean, the fucking TARDIS console room was basically the same for the entirety of Classic Doctor Who. Like, they changed it a little bit. Like, the first Doctor's was, like, more different than the others. It's like, there's, like, little bits here and there. That's like, it was fundamentally the same thing. Then they had the weird wood panel, like, secondary control room for a little bit of the Fourth Doctor era. And that was, like, the weirdest they got. But it was, like, the same basic control room. And I think they finally hit on such a, like, brilliant, timeless design, such a great set that feels lived in and futuristic and cool, and it gives the actors so much stuff they can do. It gives the crew so much stuff they can do with the lighting and the way they can shoot it. Like,
yeah, I want to see the next Doctor play on that set.
Exactly.
And if I were the next Doctor, if I were the next showrunner, if I were someone directing for the upcoming season, I would want to shoot on that set.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's so good. Don't fix what ain't broken. You know, I think when we went from RTD to Moffat, RTD had a horrible set.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Moffat, I think, very rightly went in a different direction with it. But no, we do not have to change everything. We can get a new sonic screwdriver, that's fine.
Sure.
You know, but...
I mean, yeah, it's sad that we only had this little bit with this new sonic screwdriver, because it's really cool.
And he barely used it, because he still went back to the sunglasses for several episodes this year. Yeah.
I don't know if Jodie Whittaker can play guitar, but if she can, I would not mind that being an ongoing thing every once in a while. I don't think that, like, I think 12 will always be, like, the rock doctor, but I don't think that means that, like, no other doctor could ever play the guitar again, you know?
It's true.
Yeah.
I am, this is a weird thing to wonder, I am wondering what her hair color is going to be on Doctor Who.
Sure.
Because she's brunette on Broadchurch and she was blonde in the trailer, so I don't know where they're going with that.
Then also, like, I'm curious what costume is going to be. Like, we are not equipped to try to speculate on what it is, but... I'm curious where they're going to go with it.
And the hair thing, that's not just a girl thing. Peter Capaldi also changed his hair between seasons 8 and 9. He basically got it much messier, which I liked.
Yeah. Do you think they should bring the question marks on the costumes back from the J&T years?
You know, I think, boy.
Maybe just a tasteful one that you can kind of see.
I think it would be fun to try it out. So much of that, I think, will depend on once they... start writing scripts and start getting a feeling for, like, what is her doctor like?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Sylvester McCoy could own the fuck out of that.
Yes,
it
he
does,
could.
It does, but like, I don't know, if you put that on Peter Capaldi, that'd be ridiculous. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It really does depend on the actor.
I'm just saying this, like, I feel like since they have, or Stephen Moffat has in his own small, weird, like, kind of, like, debatable way, canonized the Doctor as Doctor Who, that means now he has to have his fucking, or she has to have her question marks back.
Yes. Does the pronoun thing get hard for us from here on out?
I think we'll just... Like,
I think we'll be fine.
...refer to the Doctor as her for the run of Jodie Whittaker. Yeah.
That's probably,
I don't think it has not been, I don't think, an issue when talking about the Master, so...
No.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
It's something where I hope that's not something they have to, like, do every single episode in New Doctor. You can have a couple of pronoun jokes every once in a while. A good pronoun joke is always nice.
Yeah.
Don't make it
the I think it's okay if you have the new Doctor make it about herself at some point of, like, when I was, like, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, that's also the thing, is that probably most of the people she's going to start meeting wouldn't know that.
It's a good point,
You know, right? Like, and I am interested, actually, to see. I think there are a couple of characters I would like to have be brought into the orbit at some point. Like, I think some people mentioned, as good of an ending as River Song had in these last few years, somewhere down the line, I think that would be an interesting thing. Like, if in a couple of years, when Stephen Moffat has had a requisite break and wants to write another episode, that would not be a bad script to write.
Yeah, it's something where I'm torn between, like, the Husbands of River Song is such a perfect ending for that character. It, like caps that story off so beautifully. That, like, I kind of want it to just stay that way. On the other hand, it is, like, I think Alex Kingston would have a lot of fun.
Yes.
Yeah. So that would, yeah.
Alex Kingston, another person now that's like, it's too bad she can't play the Doctor.
Uh-huh.
Because,
I mean, she got as close, I think, as an actor could on that show without playing the Doctor, honestly.
Yes. But, yeah, we do realize, like, since women weren't playing the Doctor for all these years, a lot of people who would have been perfect for it have already played significant parts.
Yeah.
But, yes. What else was I going to say about what's coming up on this?
I've got a point that I think, I think you should change the opening titles. Like, I think it's time to do that. But keep the credits face.
Yes,
opening credits face.
Like,
it's just, it never go back. You've, like, it's one of, like, the brilliant things about Stephen Moffat's run on the show is that he finally put his foot down and said, the credits face was a fucking thing. It's awesome. It's weird and creepy, but it has to Yes. It has to be there.
Yes. Jodie Whittaker should get a credits face, and it should wink.
Yeah, I was just thinking that too. I was just thinking, like, particularly like the very wistful expression she has in like the little like teaser video they've shot. I can definitely see her doing the Seventh Doctor style, like three frame, like wink, open.
Yes.
Like, yes, and I'd be all for that.
And I still have a dream that we do that for Peter Capaldi's last episode and let him wink.
Yeah, there's a chance. But yeah.
Who knows? I also really hoped that his last episode would be called Twelfth Night to really bring that all together, and it's just called The Doctors, and that's boring.
It's unfortunate. No. Eventually, I mean, there's a part of me that, as enough to person who's an insane mega Doctor Who fan who's seen all of Doctor Who, I totally understand why Stephen Moffat would do that, because there's this desire to keep the multi-Doctor stories titled something The Doctors, or just like The Doctors.
That's true.
You have to keep the tradition alive somehow, some way.
I see. I just think the 11th hour to 12th night would be such a beautiful way to cap his legacy. But yes, let's see. I hope that the 13th Doctor's first line when she regenerates at Christmas is just again about being ginger, and there's someone in the room who's like, huh? And she does not notice until like the next episode.
Yeah.
Because I totally believe that, coming from what we know of like the Doctor at this point in his / her life with Peter Capaldi, the gender thing would not be the first thing on his / her mind.
No, yeah.
When regenerating. And I think that would just be a, like, I definitely think there's a good chance that will be the line at Christmas, will be something about the ginger thing, because that would just be a funny way to undercut that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am really looking forward to seeing that. Like, it's always fun having the scene where the actor gets to like pop up in these raggedy old clothes that don't fit them.
Yep.
I think that's going to be fun.
Well, and here's the thing: we kind of missed that with the 12th Doctor because Matt Smith's clothes fit him too well.
Yeah, it actually looked good enough, because also it was Matt Smith's like second costume with the nice purple, like kind of velvety looking coat that he had only worn for like half a season in a special.
Yes.
So it's like, hey, you could kind of keep this as a costume, and I almost wouldn't like mine.
Right. But yeah, Jodie Whittaker, I want to see her in Peter Capaldi, whatever crazy costume he's wearing. Yeah. Just like it was really fun when Matt Smith wore, you know, the 10th Doctor stuff for the 11th hour.
But have it like with the 11th Doctor. It's just totally destroyed.
Yep.
It's just like this just ruined, which they have set up, because assuming that the 12th Doctor does not change his costume over the course of the Christmas special, his costume's already super fucked up by the end of the last episode. So
yes, it's like Batman at the end of an Arkham game.
Exactly, yes. Just everything's ripped up. You're like, that's not even a coat anymore. I think like enough of that material has been shaved off that it's like a vest, maybe?
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think about the age of the Doctor here.
Sure.
So Jodie Whittaker is, I think, 35, 36.
Yeah,
35. So like 10 years older than Matt Smith was. I don't actually remember how old David Tennant was when he picked it up.
I think probably around mid-30s.
Yeah, so kind of going back to that age range. But so I think that's interesting. You know,
I think that's more or less like kind of the median age is around the mid-30s for a Doctor. So that's...
She definitely does not have the problem of reading too young on screen for the Doctor.
No, I don't think so.
Which, you know, I still like when Phoebe Waller-Bridge was being rumored, I think she's a phenomenal actress. She's also in the second season of Broadchurch in an underwritten part, but whatever. She does seem like young to me in a way that, like, I don't know if I could see the Doctor being that young.
Right.
Although I would have said that about Matt Smith before seeing him.
Yeah.
So.
But I think it would also be hard, like, having had Matt Smith, like, not that long ago.
Yeah.
I think going to, like, an actor that's that young would be a mistake.
Yeah. So that's interesting. You know, I think there's a long-term future discussion to have, too, about Doctor Who.
Right.
I do love, like, in the diegesis of the show, the idea that, you know, the Doctor is on this new regeneration cycle that was established in Smith's last episode. And I like the idea that for the second cycle, his first regeneration was Peter Capaldi, like, kind of uber-Doctor version of, like all the Doctors in one in a lot of ways. And then the Doctor just starts regenerating into a lot of different things. Like, I want to see the Doctor be a woman a couple times.
Yeah.
We need to get our Black Doctor, Asian Doctor. Like, they should... Yeah. I know people are like, oh, but you shouldn't check the boxes. No, it's time to check the fucking boxes.
Sure.
I really, like, that's... There's a reason you do that. And part of that is there are exciting actors who were not considered before.
Yeah.
You know, I want the period in Idris Elba's career when he is not so busy with movies that he plays the Doctor, because that would be fucking amazing.
God.
Everyone wants him to play James Bond. I want him to be the Doctor.
Yeah, it would be... Fuck. That would be... Can you just imagine fucking Idris Elba just, like, strolling into a room and, like, Davros is there? It's like, he doesn't even say anything. He just looks at Davros and Davros is like, I'm sorry! And he's like, I will call back the fleet!
Yes. Yes, that's what I want.
Will.
It's gonna be... No, and this is why it's fun, is now that they've opened that door, the sky's the limit.
God, you know, now I can't stop thinking about Idris Elba as the Doctor.
Yeah, he's,
that should be the next one.
You know, and I said this on Twitter. I think one day when she also is less busy with things, Olivia Colman is just going to have to play the Doctor once now that the Doctor can be a woman, because she is one of the best actors in Britain. And I think she will be bringing like a Peter Capaldi level of like worldliness
and experience
to it. And that will be amazing when that one day happens, and I hope it does. But, and I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, obviously. We have, you know, hopefully at least 3 seasons of Jodie Whittaker to look forward to.
Right,
and, you know, I'm in an optimistic position because we are coming off this insane creative hot streak for the show. This wonderful, you know, one-of-a-kind performance from Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
And we are handing the show over to a guy who I think is a tremendous writer in Chris Chibnall.
Yeah, and a really talented showrunner.
Yes.
Obviously.
And I know we're handing it over to a really good actress in Jodie Whittaker. And I'm just... this is such a good time to be a Doctor Who fan. There's all these exciting new things happening. We've been on a good streak. I think we're heading towards interesting good times. There's nothing I'm not excited about the Doctor Who experience at the moment, you know?
Yeah. It's one of those things where I feel like it would be very fascinating to just go back and re-listen to like the podcast we talked about like right before this season Doctor Who, when like we found out that Peter Capaldi was leaving. We're like, "Oh fuck, no, he's leaving." And it's like still, my fantasy world would be like Peter Capaldi is just able to film like weird Doctor Who side stories like 2 or 3 times a year that don't take place anywhere in like the normal Doctor Who like ongoing storyline, or just like he gets to have fun adventures around with like Nardole and stuff. Like, ideally, I would still just love to see normal Doctor Who adventures with him. But I feel like season 10 did such a fucking unbelievably good job at bringing that character around to a conclusion. And like Stephen Moffat's era on the show to a conclusion that I'm very excited to get started on, like my modern Doctor Who rewatch I want to do, and just like, because I think there's like, he has managed to find a way to sort of like at the end of this run, I think, comment on like the entirety of these like 10 plus years of new Doctor Who and put this era to like this interesting spot where it feels ready to end and to move on to this new step, which is like the essence of Doctor Who is that moment of change, you know. And you go back to that speech that the Doctor gave at the end of the Return of Doctor Mysterio, where he says, you know, everything ends and it's always sad, but things always begin again, and that's always happy.
And that's exactly where we are.
Yeah, that's the phase we are in with Doctor Who, and I'm sad to see Peter Capaldi go. I'm extremely excited to see the Christmas special, obviously, with having David Bradley there and everything. But then also, I'm extraordinarily excited to see where the show is going to go in the future, who, like, what kind of Doctor Jodie Whittaker is going to be, and then what kind of show Chris Chibnall is going to bring, you know? Like, I'm curious, if there's going to be larger... because I would be very open, honestly, at this moment, to even, like, larger structural changes for Chibnall's run if he wants to do a more, like, Key to Time, Trials of Time Lord-style, like, full season-long story thing that's a bit more heavy on the narrative. Like, I would be open to that, even though I think the heart of Doctor Who is obviously the individual storyline stuff. There are always periods in the show where you can, like, do the big, crazy, like, War Games, the Daleks Master Plan. It's been happening forever in Doctor Who.
And we're on season 11.
Exactly.
So let's remember that.
It's time to, like the heart of Doctor Who will always be the individual storylines, but I think there's a good opportunity for Chris Chibnall, because, you know, we've seen how fucking amazing he is with Broadchurch at bringing some of that stuff together. I would be really interested to see him doing that with Doctor Who.
You know, he's not a director, but Broadchurch has such an extraordinary visual style. That's honestly one thing I would like to see if he brings to the show. Because the Moffat years have been very handsome. And I think the increase in budget, and clearly I think their adventurousness in how they shoot the show has gone up. And they've had some terrific directors like Rachel Talalay who have done amazing things. But I would like to see if Chibnall might be interested in bringing a more unified visual spark to things.
Sure.
Because, you know, we've gone from Doctor Who being kind of an ugly show for most of its life.
That is the part of the new Doctor Who rewatch I'm like most dreading, is like, fuck. Like, some of those early RDD years look real rough now.
Yeah, to, I think, being a really visually nice show, but I think they could go further.
Sure.
And I'd be interested to see what, you know, he's interested in doing with that. And let's also just take a step back. This is the 13th time they've had to cast a main numbered Doctor.
Yeah.
They still haven't fucked it up.
Uh-huh.
This is amazing. That as you say, they've never gone for the 23-year-old male or female supermodel.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't made the giant mistake. You know, they have had periods where creatively things are rough. But, you know, for people who want to shoot back Colin Baker at us, that's not Colin Baker's fault.
No, he was fucking awesome. Like, yes. I was watching some clips of, as I always do, I'm like constantly in the process of just watching random clips of Doctor Who on YouTube. And, like, I was watching some Colin Baker ones just the other day. I was like, man, he's so fucking good.
Did you see Colin Baker's tweet on this?
Yeah.
Where he said, he basically said about Jodie Whittaker, change and not a moment too soon, which is his first line, which is a wonderfully weird ending to Caves of Androzani. And Colin Baker's cool.
Yes. Yeah.
But, yeah, again, 13 times, they haven't fucked it up. That's really good.
Uh-huh.
Because one day, by the law of averages, it will have to happen. But it hasn't.
I don't think it ever will. I think there's some magic in Doctor Who. It will never even be. As like, I will always have this weird stress dream about, like, oh God, they finally shot it, the show in the head. They've done the thing that they'll never be able to crawl back from. But they haven't. It hasn't happened yet. And the show has been on for a very long time now. So maybe it will just never happen.
Yes. And really do, Chris Chibnall, think about my David Tennant playing Jamie's grandson idea. Because I think there's something there.
I mean, that would be, if that's what you want to do for the first companion for, like, this new doctor, I mean, I would be open for that.
Yes. Maybe too big a personality to put next to the
doctor. It's like, you know, you have to put the actor playing the doctor through the ringer. Like, this is, here you go, Jodie Whittaker. Now, like, you have to be the lead across from David Tennant being full on, like, grumpy Scottish David Tennant. And you steal his thunder? I think she could do it.
Because Jamie's grandson would still be from, like, the Highlands era, right?
Because he was from, I think he was, like, the early 19th century. It was either the early 19th century or the early 17th century. I don't remember.
So he would still be, like, an old, angry Scotsman.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you would, like, look at cell phones and be like, what the fuck is this shit?
Yeah.
Krakatoa.
All right, let's move on to some other news.
What else has been happening in the world of the news?
I hate to bring us down immediately, but I do have the sad news on our list, which is over the weekend, George A. Romero passed away, the creator, of course, of zombies, basically.
Yes.
Let's just give him his due.
Yes, that is the way to phrase it.
Passed away at the age of 77, ripe old age, and I don't have a ton of experience with his work. I have a ton of respect for the man, because he seemed like, one, a very nice dude. Everyone loved him.
Yeah.
He created the most ripped-off thing of modern media.
Uh-huh.
And that's amazing.
And it's somehow the zombie genre is just, it's on this, like, crazy, like, curve of, like, it's always getting more popular. I feel like since Night of the Living Dead, zombies are always getting more popular. There's maybe was, like, a dip in the 90s, but that, like, dip was then rectified with, like, an insane shot up at the beginning of the 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, like, if there were any justice in the world, he would be the richest man on Earth just from, like, royalties of everyone who ripped him off.
Yeah, everyone who did anything with zombies that was not specifically, like, Haitian-style zombies, which nobody does that. Nobody does voodoo zombies. Anyone that's doing the Romero style zombies, they should have had to pay him at least like $5. And even then, if that was all it was, he'd be the richest person on the planet.
Yeah. But you obviously, I think, have more of a love for those movies. Because I'm not a huge horror geek. I have nothing against it. It's just not my genre. But what do you want to say about Mr. Romero?
Yeah, I think it's something where, like, because there's two sides of it. There's the, like, he is this guy who, with Night of the Living Dead, like, created zombies. Like, it is something where there have that, like, the concept in the word of zombie technically existed before him as this, like, Haitian sort of supernatural thing. You know, if you want a movie like that, you can do the white zombie movie with the old Universal Studios horror movie with, like, Bela Lugosi and stuff. That movie's okay. But, like, the idea of when you think of zombie and what you see in your head of, like, the rotting corpses, like, wandering the earth and attacking and eating humans in this sort of, like, apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic genre, George A. Romero 100% created that with Night of the Living Dead and then, like, the sequels, that whole, like, dead. I only saw the first four. He ended up, I think, making six, ultimately. I haven't seen the last two. But that Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, and Land of the Dead, which I like all those movies. Like, a lot of people don't like Land of the Dead that much. Land of the Dead's really good. And people don't like Day of the Dead either. Day of the Dead, also really fucking good. Like, Night of the Living Dead is the best one, and they get a little bit worse with each successive one, but they're all really good movies. And he really created this whole genre and this whole monster and this whole idea of what is, like, the defining horror monster of modernity, of, like, the latter half of the 20th century and going on for the foreseeable future until something new comes around. But it's like the zombie is the perfect monster for today, in the way that, like, if you think about the latter Victorian era when, like, vampire fiction and stuff first started becoming popular with, like, Dracula and Dracula's predecessors, the vampire was the perfect monster for, like, Victorian London of, you know, this, like, sexy gentleman who stalks the night and seduces women, who's also from some foreign land and embodied, like, all the weird paranoias of that culture. And the zombie is, like, we live in this, like, intense, crowded, consumerist world where there are all these faceless people around us constantly just, like, going about their own lives in this, like, from your perspective, this seemingly mindless state, and what if one day all those people just turn on you? And, like, that's the fear that the zombie genre sort of captures. And, you know, Night of the Living Dead is an absolute classic. Like, it's a classic movie I think everybody should watch, like, whether you're interested in horror or not. It's like, people, like, maybe don't know, if you haven't seen Night of the Living Dead, that movie is mostly about race. Like, that, it has one of the most chilling endings of any horror movie I've seen, where, like, that, like, the racial sort of undercurrent of that movie kind of, like, comes to a broil at the last moment in the climax, and, like, kind of the last sequence and last couple of shots of that movie, like, I think are unbelievably haunting and are, like, as relevant now as they have ever been.
And it's, you know, just worth thinking about, in the lifetimes of most of the people who I imagine listen to this podcast, there still has not been a work of genre fiction like that, with the nuclear fallout of that movie, you know,
in
terms of the impact on Pi. And it's amazing that, and obviously it's about the sequels he made too, but that you can kind of make one work like that, and it's still, like, having that, almost like the creation, the Big Bang, and it gets faster as it's accelerating, you know?
Especially when, like, you know, Night of the Living Dead was made with, like, a pebble and a piece of string, you know? Like, it was, like, all the people that were actors in that movie are, like, were not, like, film actors or something. They were, like, people he knew that were, like, community theater actors and stuff like that. And like, you know, they had chocolate syrup and that was the blood, you know? They had, like, sausage links and that was people's intestines, but... You know, it was, the movie was made in, like, 1968 or something. It's, like, it's shot in black and white because it was way cheaper to do it that way. Not because color photography had not been a thing for, like, decades to that point, you know? So it's, like, George A. Romero managed to, like, he had that just, like, student filmmaker, like, drive and this, like, capacity to, with, like, virtually nothing but, like, his friends, his camera, and, like, an ingenuity to be able to film this movie that, like, spawned this whole thing. And then when he got more successful, he made the sequels, which again I think are all great. I think it's really fun to watch all of them in quick succession because, you know, it's like tracks the development of the zombie apocalypse. And by the time you get to Land of the Dead, like Day of the Dead and Land of the Dead are about how the zombies start becoming more intelligent, and that's really cool and interesting. It's almost like a Planet of the Apes kind of thing at some point, like just, where they, like, the zombies start taking over the world.
And a step we don't see in zombie
stuff. No, yeah, the zombie stuff always stops at the Dawn of the Dead level thing. It never goes to the, like, well, what if the zombies start rebuilding civilization kind of in their own image? And it's like, it's a very sort of like I Am Legend, Bridget Matheson style thing, but like, It's the best movie version of that story I've seen done, of, like, that concept.
It should also be, like, I have not seen the later ones he did in the 2000s.
Yeah.
But from everything I can tell about them, he started experimenting with the form.
Yeah, he did, like, a found footage one.
Yeah, and ways that, like, again, like, and people are very mixed on those movies, but I still really like that he was the guy who was, he didn't just create zombies, he was willing to keep experimenting with what that meant.
Because that's the other thing, is like all those movies, like at least the ones I've seen, like Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, and Land of the Dead, those are all super different movies. Like, they're completely fucking different. They have, I mean, they all take place in the same, like, kind of universe and chronology, but they have, like, I mean, all, obviously, you know, all the cast of characters are different because, you know, basically everyone dies at the end of all those movies. They are zombie movies. But it is, like, the themes and ideas that they tackle and kind of, like, the cast of characters that they choose to do. Like, Day of the Dead all takes place on a military camp, and there's, like, a group of civilians that is there, and then there's obviously, like, all the military people that are there. And a lot of that movie is about the tension between those two groups, and there's a lot of, like, you know, one of, like, the civilian side, there's a woman who's, like, one of the figureheads there. And obviously, like, on the military side, there's this guy who's the figurehead there. It's just, they're really great movies. They're fascinating movies. Again, Night of the Living Dead is, like, I think, if you have any interest in, like, film and the history of film, that's a must-see movie. But then if you have any interest in, like, horror and particularly zombie films, all those movies are must-see, and they are the backbone of that entire genre, which that entire genre is the backbone of, like, modern horror fiction in so many ways.
And all modern video games to an extent.
And all modern video games, yes. If it was not for George A. Romero, I don't know what video game developers would do for their, like, fodder enemies in video games.
At some point, Mario's going to get a zombie mode.
There might already be a Mario game that has a zombie mode we don't even know of.
Who knows?
But yeah, you know, pour one out for old George, because, man, he had a fucking career. He had an unbelievable impact on the cinematic and pop cultural landscape. And people should, if you are underestimating Night of the Living Dead and thinking that it's like, oh, it's not going to be interesting, or it's like it's too old-fashioned of a movie, do not underestimate that movie under any circumstance.
Let's put it this way. if you think The Walking Dead is the definitive zombie thing.
Yeah, if you think the idea of, like, oh, kid zombies and, like, oh, they made it, like, a kid was a zombie. Like, that's the one thing that in The Walking Dead Season 1 video game, everyone's like, oh, man, all the stuff with, like, this kid becomes a zombie. It's just like, you never fight. Kid zombies maybe go back to the beginning of modern zombies. That's maybe there's a really classic, unbelievably scary, unsettling, disturbing scene in Night of the Living Dead that maybe involves a zombie who's a kid. I don't know.
All right, well, we will find out.
Stay away from trowels. They're dangerous.
Let's move on to some more trivial stuff. Ni No Kuni 2 Revenant Kingdom. Did I get the title right?
I think so.
Has been delayed to January of 2018.
Yeah.
January 19th, to be honest.
So that's a little bit of a
delay. And, you know, they said it was, like, to finish the game. I'm guessing this is more in the vein of, like, Gravity Rush 2 last year, right. Which is, like, oh, no one's going to play our game if we put it out.
Yeah, we're not going to put it next to fucking, like, Assassin's Creed and Mario and Wolfenstein and Call of Duty. Like, we can put this game out whenever the fuck we want. Yeah. Let's put it out in January. We'll buy it.
And I will say my reaction to this was, phew.
Yeah.
Because now I will play this game.
Yeah, I'm looking at it too.
Before, I don't know when I would have played it. Because, again, we have the deluge that is October 27th. Yeah. And then we have the deluge that is the first week of November. And then the year is kind of over. But we'll still be catching up through the end of the year. So, yeah. Anyway, just wanted to mention that because now I feel like you can probably count on us covering that game.
Yeah, in a way that we probably would not have if it came out in the middle of fall.
Yeah, which would have been dumb. So, good on them. Over the weekend, they released a new and our biggest trailer yet for Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yeah.
Which is a long-anticipated game is underselling it a little bit.
God, when Kingdom Hearts 2 came out in, like, 2004, 2005, right? It's been a long time for those
games. Very long time.
I mean, they have put out, like, 15 fucking Kingdom Hearts games in between there, but not the big console ones that people have wanted.
No. So, the interesting thing about this trailer is it did two things. One, it gave a release window for the first time of 2018. Do we believe
they're not going to hit? No. Okay. That's ridiculous. I mean, how many release windows did they give for fucking Final Fantasy 15?
This is a good point. Yes. Okay, so we're not expecting that. But the bigger thing was we got our first Pixar world in a Kingdom Hearts game, is my understanding, and it's a Toy Story world. Yeah. And I will say, I have not played the Kingdom Hearts games to completion ever. I've seen my brother play a lot of them. He loves the main games. And he's played the DS ones. He's by no means played every spinoff because you would have to own, like, weird Japanese cell phones.
Yeah, you have to own every single console that has ever been released. Somehow they, like, went back and made a fucking Intellivision Kingdom Hearts game at some point, I think.
Indeed. But I do love Toy Story. And I actually think Toy Story has an interesting history of fun video game stuff. And this looked really cool, how they were, like, imagining the Toy Story world. And
like,
just
all the, like, because Sora and Goofy and Donald also had, like, a Toy Story-esque remake, or, like, makeover on them that I thought looked good.
It looked cool. It was also fun to look at that and be like, CGI has come so far that this looks better than Toy Story 1.
Right?
Which is crazy.
Yeah, that's something that, like, also looking at, like, I was rewatching, because they, like, released, like, a small, like, documentary, 2-minute, like, trailer-esque thing for that Spider-Man game, and I was looking at some of the footage from that, I was like, this looks better than the CGI from the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I rewatched that relatively recently, I was like, fuck, video games have come a long way, man.
Yes. But no, that looked cool. I liked how they had, you know, Sora, Donald, and Goofy come up, and they tell Buzz and Woody their problems, and Buzz and Woody get the, like, the army soldiers out and how to send them out, and then it just, all the gameplay they showed looked really fun and creative. And, you know, that is kind of the thing that, if I went through Kingdom Hearts, I think is the thing that would attract me to them, is how they reimagine the different worlds.
Right.
There's a lot of fluff around that that is what I think keeps me back from Kingdom Hearts. Although they're on PS4 now, maybe I'll give them a chance.
Yeah, you can get Kingdom Hearts 1.5 plus 2.5 and get Kingdom Hearts 4 50 years early than when the game's actually released.
Indeed. But yeah, so I thought that looked cool. The part where they showed kind of the little third-person shooter part of Toy Story, there's a Toy Story ride, or at least there was, at Disney's California Adventure that was really fun back in the day where you would, like, get on your little thing and you'd go through, and it was like, well, they had two. They had a space one and they had a cowboy one, and I remember both of those being a lot of fun, and this looked very much like that kind of thing. So that looked neat. And I like that Disney is allowing them to play with the license a little more.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's the thing. When a Kingdom Hearts console game was last released, Disney did not own Pixar.
That's right. That's why they haven't done it yet.
That, to be fair, they did own Toy Story, so that wouldn't have affected that. But they didn't own any of the other Pixar brands. So that's just like, yeah, that's kind of funny to me. But yeah, and that makes me excited, because I think if I were to pick a Pixar world, it would be Toy Story.
Sure, yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Obviously.
And that are Cars.
Yeah, that are... Yes.
I just want to see, like, who gives a fuck about Sora? Like, I want to see Goofy and Donald turn to do Cars.
I want that to just be a video game, like, origin story of what the fuck happened in the Cars universe to make it the Cars universe.
That's what they, like, yeah, no, like, they all go there, and that's the thing, is you don't know it's the Cars universe yet.
Yes.
It's just, like, a normal world, and you're like, this is just, like, normal people walking around, and then, like, over the course of your adventure, you, like, destroy this world and trap everyone's souls into automobiles.
You know, I think 20 years down the line, Disney is going to reboot Cars, and it's going to be Rise of the Planet of the Cars, and we're going to learn how the cars were, like, tested on.
Yeah, and they get Andy Serkis to mocap the cars. It's like, yes. Man, like, I thought it was impressive that you could, like, replicate, like, in a vague way, chimp musculature. Now you're, like, replicating fucking automobiles.
It's going to be great.
I just had a crazy thought, though.
Yes.
When thinking about, oh, they trap souls into the cars, and that's what Cars is. Is Cars an elaborate prequel to Transformers? Like, is
it could
that
be.
In like 5,000 years in the future from Cars, is that what they become? Is fucking like Autobots and Decepticons?
I don't know.
That I blew my mind with
Michael Bay apparently isn't directing Transformers movies anymore.
I mean,
maybe
he
that's
said that after every fucking Transformers movie.
I know, but maybe that's because this time he's moving on to do Cars 4, Transformers 6.
Yes, they finally fuse the Transformers Cars cinematic universe.
Anyway,
the Dark Universe.
Anyway,
we'll now call it.
I thought that was a very fun little trailer for Kingdom Hearts 3. Looked charming. I liked hearing Japanese buzz and
whee. That's always the best part about these little trailers they've been doing a bit here, is getting all the Japanese Disney actors and being like, that's crazy.
Because here's the thing. You know they're not going to have Tom Hanks in the actual game, right?
I mean, who knows? Maybe Tom Hanks' son like really loves Kingdom Hearts or something. You don't know that.
Maybe they can get Chet Hayes, his rapper son.
There you go, yeah.
Or Colin Hanks, the famous one.
Yeah.
But no, I was going to go with Chet Hayes. Anyway, so that looks cool. Kingdom Hearts 3, 2018, but probably not.
No.
That's really what it should have said. 2018, but probably not.
The Kingdom Hearts story.
Yes. This was released, I don't think, as part of this, but it was during this period, is Disney had their big conference over the weekend, D23.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's called that, but it's called
It always makes me think of, like, that would be the craziest looking dice ever. It's you roll a D23 for initiative.
Indeed. All right, so there was some fun stuff out of this. I just wanted to hit some interesting points. The most exciting thing to me was we got the trailer for Ava DuVernay's Wrinkle in Time movie.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was cool. Did you ever read that as a kid?
I think I did, but it's like I was a kid, and I never, like, it's been something that I've kind of been thinking about actually going to those books, because I know they're really beloved, and I feel like I read the first Wrinkle in Time, but I would not remember enough to be, like, definitive if that was actually Wrinkle in Time or something else.
I read A Wrinkle in Time, and it made a huge impact on me, because I could not tell you, like, the exact story of that book anymore, but I remember specific images and, like, turns of phrase and just the general insanity of that book, and that it was by far kind of the weirdest, wildest book I read as a kid, most kind of out on a limb, I think, in terms of children's literature. It's more than children's literature, but, you know, like, I can remember, like, the library book I had borrowed, what it felt like, and I remember reading it while we were waiting to go to dinner at a Bojo's once. Like, I just, there's little images, because that book left an impact on me.
I have a very incredibly distinct impression of me reading The Hobbit, like, on a grassy hill at my brother's fucking soccer practice. Because basically my entire childhood was lived while being ferried around to my brother's different sports practices, because he played every fucking sport on the planet. And reading The Hobbit while eating Cheetos and getting, like, Cheeto stains on all the pages, being like, this, I learned a lesson that day. Don't eat Cheetos while you're doing something else. Only eat Cheetos when your hands are otherwise unoccupied.
That I learned that lesson reading Harry Potter 2, but The Hobbit I remember reading in Telluride, because we were there and we were in a hotel in Telluride, and that's where I started reading The Hobbit. Anyway, this could be a fun thing, but no. So Wrinkle in Time, I think, is a movie that is ripe for a big cinematic adaptation. Ava DuVernay is a great director, and I thought that trailer just, like, it's like, yep, that looks awesome and weird. And that's what I want. Oprah's in it. And Oprah, I think a lot of people don't realize, she's a really good actress.
Sure.
And she also looks awesome in that costume.
Yes, she does. Yeah.
Yes. Oprah knows how cool Oprah is.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the takeaway there. I liked seeing Chris Pine there, which also meant at D23 they had all the Chris's there on stage.
Because they
had Chris Pine. And then for Avengers they had Chris's, Hemsworth, Pratt, and Evans.
There really are a lot of them. I feel like they're multiplying at some point.
There's a lot of Chris's. So that was fun. Wrinkle in Time trailer. That's a Disney movie I'm looking forward to, because it's not a remake of anything.
No. Yeah, I'm also looking forward to the next Disney thing that they do, where they could just have the Chris convention, and it's just like, get them all together, the big Chris panel you can go to, just have all the Chris's together, talk about how great it is to be a white male actor named Chris.
It's a good time for them.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's something happened at some point like 30 years ago where everyone was like, let's just name everyone Chris.
Yeah. And then they grew up to be very handsome men.
Yes.
Indeed. Okay, so speaking of Avengers, they did show off Infinity War. And sadly, they have not shown that footage online.
No,
it sounded pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, the biggest takeaway for me from that was hearing that Spider-Man sounds like he's a bigger part of that movie than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, apparently every hero is in it. They're all there.
Yeah.
The Guardians of the Galaxy hit Thor with their ship, which, that to me, like, alone shows they know what they're doing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I am excited. You know, my biggest question mark with all of this still is, what is Thanos going to be like in the movie?
Right.
But people said the footage with him was cool. Josh Brolin was there and seemed game. So, hey, I'm excited.
Yeah, because we haven't gotten much with him. We got, like, a teaser at the end of Avengers 1 and, like, 3 minutes or something in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Three very shoehorned minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm interested to see what that performance will be like when he's, like, the actual antagonist of a movie.
It is interesting. For a character that they've built up as much as Thanos, the movies haven't actually built him up that much.
Yeah.
But, you know, they got two movies to work with. So, apparently Spider-Man will be using the costume Tony gave him at the end of Homecoming.
Okay,
in Avengers.
Yeah.
I like that, like, maybe in Avengers movies he uses that, and then he uses his normal costume in his own movies.
Sure, yeah.
We go back and forth. No, but that sounds fun. We heard about Incredibles 2, and we got some details on that, because that's coming out next year, after Brad Bird has been, you know, knocking this around in his head for a decade plus now. And it was kind of, I was kind of expecting that maybe Brad Bird would do something with the actual passage of time and have it happen 10 years later and have the kids grown up. And he's doing the exact opposite of that. This movie starts with the last scene of Incredibles 1, is what John Lasseter said.
I guess you have to give people a reminder because it has been a while.
Well, and the end of Incredibles 1 is where they come out and the Mole Man, voiced by John Ratzenberger, comes out. And it's fucking funny.
Yeah.
And I do think that is a fun way to start the movie. And apparently it will kind of pick up where they left off. He said he wants to shift the focus in this movie to Elastigirl rather than Mr. Incredible, which I think makes sense. He did the husband last time, we'll do the wife more this time. And Helen Hunt is awesome in that part.
Yeah.
So, hey, Incredibles 2 is like the one Pixar sequel we all wanted. So, this is cool.
I hope they all have, like, flip cell phones and everything. If it's like, all of a sudden Incredibles 2 is a fucking period piece because it's been long enough.
Well, God, I mean, it's true. The people who were kids when Incredibles came out are now 24-year-old guys hosting a podcast.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, anyway.
I mean, that was the age before podcasts.
Indeed.
And what did anyone do then?
Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to it. Apparently the only part they had to recast was the male kid Dash because male kids grow up and their voices change.
That is true.
They had to do that with Finding Nemo also.
It happened to me once.
Yes. Only once. Let's see. Incredibles 2. And then Disney showed off a bunch of stuff from their mini remakes, and they are very committed to remaking every live action or every animated movie as a live action movie. So
what are they doing? Like, what's the list right now?
Let me list some for you. They showed a video from the set of Tim Burton's Dumbo, which sounds like a terrible idea, but we'll see.
What the fuck? I already knew that, but I had forgotten it.
And here's the one thing
Burton's Dumbo.
They gave us a cast list, and Michael Keaton is in that movie, which sounds awesome. My hope, and I cannot confirm this, and I don't want to look it up because I don't want to be proven wrong, is that Michael Keaton is playing Timothy J. Mouse in mocap. And
there you go.
Timothy the Mouse in this movie is like kind of a grizzled old guy. I want that. He's probably going to be like the leader of the circus, but we'll see.
Sure, yeah. Maybe he'll be Dumbo. Who knows? It might be a very, like, passionate, like, weird, edgy reboot.
They did apparently, in the footage they showed from the set, have a very cute, they have a giant elephant cutout for Dumbo on the set where the CGI will be.
There you
and,
go.
Yeah. Let's see. So we got Tim Burton's Dumbo. We have Guy Ritchie's Aladdin, which sounds even more silly to me.
Yeah.
Because that's what you want in a story that was pretty racist towards the Middle East as a British guy directing it. Get the most colonial culture to put their stamp on that.
Yeah.
No,
exactly.
They are at least casting people of Middle Eastern-ish descent for Aladdin and Jasmine.
You can just get Jake Gyllenhaal and it's fine. Come on.
You're referencing Prince of Persia, which most people probably don't know happened.
No, but I have a running list of every video game movie ever made, even though I haven't seen almost any of them.
So they've announced Aladdin and Jasmine. They have not announced Jafar. I would put good money. How much do you want to bet that's going to be Ben Kingsley?
Yeah.
In blackface, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Because they did that in Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
And Ben Kingsley always plays, like, Middle Eastern people, even though he's British. So, yeah.
It is a significant chance.
Yes.
Yeah,
I would not be Jafar.
Yeah.
But they've also apparently cast Will Smith as the genie.
Yeah.
Which, you know,
Sure.
Sure. It, as long as they have him wrap the story over the end credits.
Yes.
That's all I want. And he didn't do it in Suicide Squad. And he didn't do it in
After Earth.
Earth. And he didn't do it in Men in Black 3. And if there was any movie he was going to come back and do that for, it would be Men in Black 3. So
he should have done it at the end of that movie where he played the like Nigerian doctor that like did all the concussion stuff for the NFL.
Yeah, concussion.
Yes, there you go.
Yes, indeed.
That, I think he could have made like a very fun, like hip, you know, rap for the kids for that one.
So we have those two. We also, and they did show, I guess, the first scene of this, Jon Favreau's The Lion King, which, stop calling it a live-action remake. There are no people in it. It is all CGI. It is a CGI remake. Stop calling it live-action. Fuck off with that.
Did they take some pictures of, like, the savannah?
Maybe. But to
there
my
knowledge, that's live in action.
No, and to my knowledge, the Jungle Book, which this is, was also Jon Favreau, right, and this is in the same style as. I think they used maybe some plates as reference material from Natural Jungles, but I think the backgrounds in that movie are all CGI.
Okay.
So this is not live action. It's like when people call Avatar a live action movie, and it grinds my gears a little bit because it's not. And I'm not saying that to dismiss the movie. But that does, I think, demean actual live-action stuff when you say that.
Sure, yeah, that's just like, you know, you want to be specific with your terms.
Like,
yeah.
War for the Planet of the Apes counts as live-action because only the apes are CG and they've shot everything else. They're not doing that with
like they made, like, yeah, like they specifically invented technologies for that series so that they could shoot on location and have, you know, CG people.
And it's a special thing. They're obviously not going to do that for The Lion King.
No.
Also, apparently, this was a literal shot-for-shot remake of Circle of Life from the animated movie, so I really question the point of this movie, but I don't know. The Jungle Book was the best of these so far, so who knows? Jon Favreau's a smart guy.
Yeah.
It could be fun, but we'll see. Donald Glover is playing Simba, and I like that.
Okay, yeah, no, there you go.
Yeah.
That's good casting.
Anyway, so yeah, those are all the Disney remakes that they are at least like shooting right now, that they're getting ready to go on.
Because they've already done Jungle Book and Beauty and the Beast. Yep. Are there any other live-action ones they've done?
Oh, they've done Cinderella, and did Maleficent, and they did...
Those aren't, like, Maleficent's not a remake.
Yeah, but...
It's a different story with those characters.
Sure, but
so
that
I
is...
count that.
That's their Sleeping Beauty movie, though. Like, they're not going to now go do a Sleeping... Well, maybe they will.
Yeah, I would not say that with any confidence at all,
Good
John.
Point. Good point.
So I mean, I guess, would you count the Alice movies, the Tim Burton Alice movies?
Yes, I would.
Okay.
Because that's what started it. Because the first
one
made $1 billion, and the second one made nothing.
But I guess they just decided to move into this phase where they're not trying to do a different story with the characters. They are just doing the movie again.
Which is weird.
People, except for when they're not doing it with people.
Yeah, and I don't know, because the it really does feel like it's the stature of the original movie that determines how close a remake it will be. Like, Beauty and the Beast is like their biggest animated movie, so the live-action one was very close. The Jungle Book is big, but not doesn't cast such a shadow that Jon Favreau mostly did his own thing with it. And, you know, I think Cinderella, from what I hear, Kenneth Branagh did a lot of his own stuff with it, because you really can't do an exact remake of the animated Disney movie.
Right.
It would be 45 minutes long.
Yeah.
You know.
It'd be a very good TV special.
Sure. So I don't know. Like, if Tim Burton of 15 years ago was doing Dumbo, I'd look forward to that. I really don't know now.
I mean, the fact that I still feel like there's no way you can say Tim Burton's Dumbo without a shitty grin on your face.
I know.
Tells you something about that movie, doesn't it?
It really does. And I'd have to think... Okay, the other thing they showed off, and this isn't a remake, it's a sequel, Mary Poppins Returns is the movie that... And it sounds like... I'm actually excited for that one, because other than absolute hack director Rob Marshall, the worst director to ever get an Oscar nomination, directing that movie, which fills me with dread, you do have Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins, which is awesome. You have fucking Lin-Manuel Miranda playing the male lead. There's a lot of cool stuff about that movie that I'm excited for. Other than hack director Rob Marshall, which really is... You know how some people, like, in the trailers, it's like, from visionary director?
Right.
It really needs to read, from hack director Rob Marshall, the guy who made Pirates of the Caribbean 4, the most expensive movie ever made, look like the cheapest movie ever made? That should be his logline. He's a hack. Anyway.
If they just said, like, from the dude that brought you Pirates of the Caribbean 4, and everyone's like, they made a fourth one? It's like, they made a fifth one!
Yeah. That's the one you really don't know about. Davy Jones comes back.
Yeah, apparently.
He's not going to come back again. Anyway, so yeah, D23, Disney going to Disney.
They're slowly taking over the world.
They are. I think the real question is, what do they do once they've remade all the animated movies? Do they remake them, but now in animation?
I mean, yeah, they bring back 2D animation.
Yeah.
Yeah, bring it back from Western 2D animation.
Or at that point, has it been long enough that you can just, like, release Dumbo in theaters and no one knows it's an old movie?
Sure, yeah, because, like, the 2D animation looks so good, they're like, oh, this is amazing. Or, here's the thing, maybe by the time they're done with their, like, live-action remakes of their full catalog, you know, you get, like, Little Mermaid and all that shit done, then you start doing the live-action direct-to-DVD sequels. So you do, like, Lion King 2, but in live-action. You do Little Mermaid 2, but in live-action. You do Haunted 2, like, all those.
The Lion King 1.5.
Yeah, the Lion King 1.5, thank you, yeah. You do all those, put those all, get those all live-action. By then, in the year, you know, 2256 or whatever, virtual reality will finally have been, like, accepted by the larger public, and then they can start over, but now they're, like, virtual reality movies. So then it's like, you know, you just keep on. Disney's just going to keep on keeping on.
Yep.
Disney. They don't need to make new movies. They just need to make old movies.
We also did see the little behind-the-scenes feature for The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
The little bit of Carrie Fisher at the end that brought a tear to my eye.
Yeah.
So that's gonna be kind of rough when we have to watch.
God, that movie is... I mean, it's not like immediately, but that movie is not that far away. It feels like that movie went from being like, oh, that's like a year away, to being like, no, that's like... a half a year away.
Yeah.
And I don't know when that time passed.
All right, two more pieces of news. The Criterion Collection announced their October titles, and we don't obsessively cover that, obviously, here, even though I obsessively buy Criterions.
Yeah.
But I wanted to mention this because we all love Twin Peaks.
Yes.
If you're listening to this still, you probably have some interest in Twin Peaks.
Hopefully.
I hope so. And they are adding Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me to the Criterion Collection this October, which is awesome, but it's an interesting case where that movie did come out on Blu-ray for the first time here in the box set they did.
Right.
With the entire TV series, and then they did the Firewalk with Me disc that also had the missing pieces bonus features. And I am curious what Criterion's plan with this movie is, because the bonus feature list they've released is pretty much just what's on the box set disc.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of wondering, is there anything different about this disc? Firewalk with Me is a great movie and belongs in the Criterion Collection, but I think a lot of Lynch fans were saying, and I was kind of one of them, that, well, Firewalk with Me did get a release. There's a lot of Lynch movies that need the Criterion treatment, like Inland Empire and Lost Highway and some of those, The Straight Story. Those would all be great. And I think the answer is this one was probably already done in
Criterion. Yeah, I mean, they already had.
That said, it does say on the page, new 4K restoration, and Firewalk with Me on the Blu-ray looks good, but does not look as good as the TV series. Like, I don't think it underwent a full restoration. So, if that's the case, I'll absolutely buy it again, because that movie's beautiful.
I'm going to pick this up, because I'm not necessarily interested in having all Twin Peaks on physical media, but I would like to have that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would probably buy it either way, just because I'm a Criterion junkie. I have his other Criterion movies. I'd like to have The Spine with Firewalk with Me. That's cool.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see what, like, essay they put together for it. But if they've actually done a new video master for that movie, I think it deserves it. Because, again, the current Blu-ray does not look bad or anything, but it could look better. I've seen that movie on 35mm, and it's a very rich experience. So, and, you know, they've done Eraserhead and Mulholland Drive, and those are phenomenal Blu-rays. So that's... I would love to have this on the shelf next to it. And to me, it's just like... 20 years later, finally getting its due, it's in the Criterion Collection, it's been canonized.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yes.
You know?
It's a great, if you are listening to this but did not listen to our Twin Peaks big podcast, like, if you have seen Twin Peaks but you have not seen Firewalk with Me, fucking watch Firewalk with Me, because it's really, really, really good.
They're also doing Barry Lyndon in October.
Oh.
Which is great. Yeah. It'll be the first time that's been on Blu-ray in the U.S. with, like, its right aspect ratio, which has been a point of contention for that film. And slowly but surely, Criterion is doing Stanley Kubrick. And I really hope they get to some of the other ones.
Yeah.
Because the Warner Brothers Blu-rays of those movies are not particularly good.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done Dr. Strangelove. They're doing this. They've done some of his older movies.
They did, like, The Killing, which I have that one. Because I really like that movie.
They did Paths of Glory. Back in the day on DVD, they did Spartacus, so hopefully they can upgrade that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, you know, that would be really cool to have Kubrick in the collection.
Yes.
He deserves it.
Yes. I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, that's
not... I'd be very surprised if you found one person on the planet that did not agree with that statement.
And yeah, Kubrick's not even, like, my favorite director, but obviously he is of sufficient historical import.
Yeah. To make it for Criterion.
Yes. Anyway, so that was fun. And then last piece of news this week is BioWare is having some shakeups.
Yeah.
Their general manager, Aaron Flynn, who's been with the company a long time, is leaving. And in his place is Casey Hudson, the once and future king of BioWare, because
he returns.
He returns. He was the director of the Mass Effect trilogy, the good Mass Effect games.
Yeah.
And he left, and I think he's been wandering as probably a monk or something, the Earth, mm-hmm. thinking of new game ideas, and now he's back at BioWare, and the company, I think, is in good hands.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool to see him come back, because that always was like one of the more recognizable sort of creative figures, names you saw with like attached to Mass Effect and all like the interviews back in the day he gave them. So
I think it instills some confidence in BioWare going forward too, after it's had kind of a rough year so far.
Yeah,
it also tells me that like that interests me in Anthem even more. That I think they're gonna have a very steady hand at the nothing against Aaron Flynn, but just Casey Hudson is a brilliant game designer, so that's cool. You know,
yeah.
As Anthem, they're gearing up for Anthem next year, which might also be 2019.
Yeah, that game is at least going to get delayed, if not delayed all the way into 2019. But it's cool to see him back.
Yeah, not too much to say. Other than this is rare. You don't usually see people leave a game company and then come back.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, we're still waiting on Amy Hennig doing Uncharted 5.
Sure, but just once her like Star Wars game comes out 5 years from now, whenever, I'm still annoyed that they have not. They have put that game, I feel, in a very firm Mass Effect Andromeda territory in terms of the marketing that is making me very scared. Because I want that game to be awesome because it has awesome people working on it.
Indeed. All right, so I think that's it for news this week. You want to talk some Twin Peaks?
Oh, let's talk about some Twin Peaks.
All right, so Twin Peaks, episode 10 of The Return. A lot of stuff happened in this episode.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot of fun. It was a very funny also.
Yeah.
But it was also extremely dark. Some crazy things happened.
It really was a roller coaster of a fucking episode. I mean, they all have been. Yes. But I think this one maybe like has some of the funniest stuff juxtaposed with like some of the most like harsh, in-your-face, like violent stuff.
Absolutely. And I think also continued to connect the dots for us in various places. And spoiler warning from here on out. Let's just get to the best thing first.
Okay.
The biggest thing I wrote in my notes.
Uh-huh.
Dougie Jones, sex god.
I mean, yeah, he does it. He does it for sure.
The look on Naomi Watts' face when she sees the very fit Kyle MacLachlan shirtless in the doctor's office.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I mean, just that whole scene is paced so unbelievably. Because it's like, you know, he takes his shirt off and, like, the camera angle, like, you very clearly can see it's like, you know, he has a very defined core, let's say. And then the doctor is, like, doing these tests, and, like, the doctor is slowly, like, realizing and making some comments, but Janie is a bit in the background, and she's not really noticing, and it's, like, the slow turn, they're just like, you have lost a lot of weight. And then that cut to her wearing the fucking red heels in the house, just, like, trying to give the most seductive look possible. Unbelievable good. Like, it's so fucking funny.
I love Naomi Watts.
Yeah.
I love her so much. She's so funny in this. But as you say, the whole pace of that, and I again love I think there is a really interesting either social spoof or social satire, depending on how deep you want to define it, going on with Dougie Jones as a character. And I think part of that is that even in zombie form, Coop Dougie has, I think, been a more like sensitive, open lover to Janie than real Dougie ever apparently was.
Yeah.
And I love that like she has fallen in love with him again, even though he is literally an empty vessel right now.
Yeah. It's like you go back to when we were talking about, you know, remember when like the biggest thing that would happen with Dougie Jones is like getting off of the elevator and how it's just like the ways he has to navigate society while being a husk and just like the weird ways it's just like standing in an elevator looking the wrong way. You're like, how it's like nobody understanding that this man needs some like serious help. But there's something about this, like he can just sleepwalk his way through society, through these like social relationships, and just like utter a random meaningless word that like is a parrot of someone else's word that they've just said. And somehow, like, nothing changes. Like, everything's fine. In fact, like you said, it might be better than the alternative.
I mean, he's doing better at work.
Yeah.
He's doing better with Janie. He is not getting into gambling problems.
He's, like, basically single-handedly stopped and, like, is responsible to the eventual capture of Ike the Spike, the notorious assassin.
Yes, you know, apparently everyone in this world knows.
Yeah, like, It's pretty remarkable what a man is able to accomplish when he's Dougie Jones / Agent Cooper.
I mean, let's go through these themes. Because, so he's at the doctor's office, and this is another thing I love. They have been teasing Dougie going to the doctor for like 4 weeks.
Uh-huh, and you keep on thinking, like, this is going to be where it starts turning. This is going to be the moment where JDE finally, like, realizes this isn't just, like, he's kind of out of it. This is, like, a severe issue that we really need to sort of investigate further. And so, but what, so that's the expectation of a normal human being would have of what would happen at the doctor's office. And how does that scene develop?
How the scene develops is first you have Naomi Watts go off on the list of like things that have been happening weird, like he missed Sonny Jim's birthday party, which again the name Sonny Jim never stops me for, or never prevents, or I always laugh at it.
Yeah,
so that's sad. And then Kyle MacLachlan takes his shirt off, and my first thing in my notes was I wrote, "Damn, Kyle MacLachlan is fucking fit."
Yeah,
and then the next thing I wrote was the line from the doctor, "Dougie, have you been exercising?" And so what happens is Kyle MacLachlan is such a specimen of a man that both the doctor and his wife are sufficiently distracted by his abs that they don't notice that he's a zombie.
Yeah. I also love earlier in this scene that they said that it's like, you know, he's been acting very peculiar. And then he just looks around, peculiar.
Yep. I had that written down, yep.
It's just like he keeps on putting the stethoscope on Kyle MacLachlan's chest, and he keeps on trying to get up. It's like, no, Dougie, no, Dougie.
So she asks, how much weight has he lost? And just every shot of her reaction, like, it's amazing. The GIFs on Twitter have been wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Just if you're ever feeling down, just pick up an image of Naomi Watts' pure animalistic pleasure at seeing Kyle MacLachlan, because it's wonderful. And they do his blood pressure and everything. And the best part to me, actually, I think, is the doctor says something about, you are in remarkable health. And then it cuts to Janie. And like Dougie, she does the parroted word, but she says, remarkable.
Yeah.
And like just this little, and then it kind of cuts and we have a different scene, but that's great. And then, yes, back at the Jones house, as you say, she has like, you know, the nice clothes on and the heels, and JD is sitting in the chair and Dougie's at the table eating chocolate cake. And I love this scene. Here, I'll read the whole thing. She says, Dougie, do you find me attractive? And he just keeps chewing. He has like no expression. And she grins. She's like, well, do you? And he looks back down at his cake. I find you attractive. He keeps eating. She smiles, and then she starts rubbing her leg and goes, Dougie. And then it's a hard cut to her furiously riding him in bed. His arms are flailing up and down in the rhythm with her.
That first shot of the, like, it's like her back in like the bed's like in the middle of the frame and his arms just going up and down.
And then you have the first cut to McLaughlin's face and he's just like in utter like animalistic bliss, just like smiling like an idiot while Naomi Watts rides him. And then she is screaming his name so loud it wakes up Sonny Jim in the next room, who is obviously terrified by this. Oh my god. And then that's where I wrote down Dougie Jones, sex god, all caps, 3 exclamation points.
Yeah.
Which really should have been the title of this episode. I know they don't do titles, but that should have been the title of this episode. Yeah. I laughed so fucking hard during this scene. And then maybe the best part is at the end, once they're in the post-orgasmic glow, Angela Badalamenti comes in with like some smooth jazz.
Yeah.
And she just turns to him and says, Dougie, I love you. And he goes, love you.
Yeah.
It's so good. And then you do have one last scene with Dougie this week, which is they're back at the Jones house right before like she takes them to school and work, and she pulls them aside like they're teenagers in like an 80s movie.
Yeah.
And she's like, I can't stop thinking about last night. You're so wonderful. I just had to tell you that. So good. That is one of the best sex scenes I have ever seen.
Uh-huh.
Because it is fucking funny, and it is awesome. And I, even though this is an incredibly weird scenario, it doesn't feel really manipulative to anyone.
Right, yeah.
Like, I feel like, you know, again, Janie is having a more responsive husband than she's had in the past, even though he's a vegetable somehow. Because, you know, Dougie Jones, he was cool, but he wasn't a good husband.
No, he had more on his mind, you know.
Yes, he did. And, you know, hey, Cooper's, you know, getting to have sex with Naomi Watts, that's good. And, yeah, I mean, the loser in this scenario is Sonny Jim, who's a little scarred. But, you know,
yeah,
he'll be fine.
It's an amazing sequence.
If this show has a happy ending, which is by no means a guarantee,
no.
I want it to be like Janie realizes, oh, you were Dale Cooper all along. Can we still be together? And he'll be like, sure. And they get a house in Twin Peaks and raise Sonny Jim. And that would be the perfect ending for Dale Cooper.
Yes.
And I also think Janie would be happy.
I like to think so, yeah.
Yeah. You know, because my one worry in everything else that's happening is Janie might get killed at some point. in from all the assassins. Jesus. But part of me thinks even David Lynch isn't that cold.
I don't think so. I don't think that would happen. But then again, I don't. Anyone is utterly incapable of predicting what the fuck is ever going to happen on this TV show. I would not have predicted that there would have been a sex scene between Vegetable Cooper and Naomi Watts. And here we are.
Let's talk about Coop a little bit. Because I really do. There was a lot of good stuff in this episode. But the Dougie Jones Cooper scenes were my favorite.
Yeah.
And I think they were some of the best Dougie Jones scenes yet. Dougie Jones is great. Yeah. And fuck you if you say otherwise.
I mean, if you don't think Dougie Jones is great, you shouldn't be watching the show.
That's
because
my point.
It is the Dougie Jones show with, like, I mean, obviously there's a lot of different subplots going on. But there's no Cooper.
Yeah.
Like that, he does not exist right now.
Like, there are still critics, I see, and I don't know why they're watching the show anymore, who are like, this is just filler until we get somewhere. It's not filler if it's most of the show.
Exactly. We're like, clearly, this is the point. Like, if I could understand the complaint if this was episode 5. Right, like then I could see like, okay, yeah, maybe like if it seemed like there was like this chance that Cooper was going to come back in the immediate horizon, we're over halfway through the series. Clearly, him being Vegetable Dougie is the fucking point.
Yes, and you don't have to like it. That's not my point. But I do think you have to, if you're watching the show, and if you're watching this show in particular, I would ask that you critically engage with it.
Yeah.
The critical engagement can be, I don't like this. I think the critical engagement cannot be, this is filler, because that's just dismissing it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not filler. This is the point of what Lynch is doing with one half of Kyle MacLachlan in this show. And you have to reckon with that. And I think we've talked a lot about, I think it is hilarious. I think there's an interesting satire going on here. I think it is, in a vein Lynch very much likes, which is taking a weird element and putting it into very mundane scenarios to kind of study those mundane scenarios. And in that vein, I love all the Dougie Jones stuff because I think it is something of a surrealistic masterpiece.
Yeah.
A la, like, it's like a Louis Spoonwell movie or something, like, is what he's pulling off here. And, again, I think what it allows Kyle MacLachlan to do as an actor, including here, show off his genuinely fantastic body for a man of his age. For a man of any age. Let's not break that down too much. You know, it's so much fun. And I think there is critical worth to it.
Oh, absolutely. Like, It's like kind of is my favorite part of the show. Like, it has been since, you know, hello, and now we're here.
Let's put it this way. Twin Peaks, the original series, had a lot of darkness and a lot of weird elements. It was also a very warm show.
Yeah.
Twin Peaks, The Return is generally not a warm show. The warmest element of new Twin Peaks, other than our somewhat, you know, infrequent interludes with Lucy and Andy, and even those have gotten pretty weird.
Yeah.
Is the Dougie Jones aspect. That's where the warmth is, and there is usually warmth somewhere in David Lynch. You know, and I think that some of the productions where maybe he goes off the rails a little bit is when he forgets about the warmth. And I think it is here, and I think it is there in the Dougie Jones stuff. And that alone makes it feel personal and important to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But I think we have seen, like, because it's also why I love about the Dougie Jones stuff and why I think, like, it is a huge mistake to just dismiss it, is that it's not one note. Like,
yeah.
It's really versatile, because I think some of, like, the most kind of, like, soulful moments of the show have been scenes with Dougie of, like, I mean, we had one in the episode last week of him, you know, looking at the American flag while the song plays, and then we had the, I still think about this, like, sequence all the time when watching the show. It was, like, several episodes back when he's has all, like, the paperwork, and he's slowly filling it out with the pencil, and then, like, just, like, drawing these weird shapes and lines and stuff while the music plays. And so I think there's a lot of meat to that performance and what is going on, I think, thematically and narratively with him. That, again, like, if you're just dismissing it as filler, you're 100% missing the point of the show, and you should watch a different show. Because it's like, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, if you're not enjoying it and it's not for you, that's fine. But, like, at least accept it for what it's trying to do instead of dismissing it because it's doing what it's trying to do.
It would be like if I watched Doctor Who and I said, what the fuck is this time travel filler bullshit?
Right.
You know, like,
yeah.
It's like, no, that's the show.
Or it'd be like if I watched Game of Thrones, it's like, why do they keep on killing off characters? This is horseshit. It's like, it's what they're doing it on purpose. It's not like an accident. It's like the part of, like, the core, like the key element of the show's design.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, nice little Game of Thrones plug, Sean.
There you go. I have never seen a single episode of it, but I can still make it.
Get some sweet SEO dollars. Yeah. Up in here. Yeah.
You know, that's our whole plan. That's what, that's, you know, we're just going to turn this whole podcast into a Game of Thrones episode any second now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just have to catch up, and then we can get all the Game of Thrones money on the internet.
We'll take the business model that apparently works for some some websites of we only get advertisements 7 weeks of the year when we do nothing but Game of Thrones coverage.
Yes.
No. Anyway, yes. So
top 10 Game of Thrones sex scenes coming to you next episode.
None of them are as hot as Janie E and Dougie Jones.
I mean, nothing could be.
The other thing, people saying Naomi Watts has not had enough to do. That's an insult to Miss Naomi Watts. I have seen that and it pisses me off. She is amazing on this show. I think she has had a lot. She is the driving force of most of...
Why, here's the... You want to see what Naomi Watts has been able to do on the show? Like, watch the fucking, like, the sex scene and, like, everything surrounding it. Watch the clip in from this scene of where you see the, like, the news footage of her explaining...
Oh, that's so funny.
She's so fucking good at that. And then watch the scene from a couple of episodes ago where she, like... takes the money to the guys that, like you know, were extorting her family from the Dougie Jones stuff, and she just, like, chews them the fuck out and just makes them leave. Like, she has done a lot on the show. Like, that character has a lot of range, and she has, like, Naomi Watts has brought such life and such, like, the insane David Lynch characterization that is necessary to play this very weird character. But she has had a lot to do.
If you don't have Naomi Watts there, that corner of the show, which is a lot of the show, doesn't work.
Yeah, no, like, she's... You know, it's like that whole, like, major plot / subplot of the entire series is like a almost kind of a two-hander between her and Kyle MacLachlan.
And it's a two-hander between two of Lynch's muses.
Exactly.
You know, in Watts and MacLachlan, and letting them do very weird different things.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, no, she's doing tremendous work. I, again, think she should get an Emmy for it, but whatever. All right. I did a Twitter poll on the Dougie Jones thing just because it struck me. We're past the halfway point. He's still Dougie. The end is not in sight. If the doctor's visit didn't do it, we're going to wait a little while for this. So I put up a Twitter poll. I've never done one of these before, but I was genuinely curious what the group think out there is.
Uh-huh.
And my Twin Peaks tweets get some engagement because people are watching and stuff. So I thought this would be a good time to ask this. I said, when do you think Cooper, quote unquote, wakes up from his life as Dougie, if at all, on Twin Peaks? I gave four options.
Yes.
Within the last roughly five episodes, with the finale... the very end of the finale, or never. And the results with about 40 votes were split 34% within the last five episodes, 32% for the finale, 8% for very end of the finale, and 26% for never. So this is completely inconclusive, but I do like that everyone is on a slightly different page.
Yes.
And I'm happy to see never got at least a quarter of the votes.
And I was one of them. That you was voted my, never? I weighed in, I put in my vote for never. Don't think it's happening.
You don't think?
It's something where, like, my brain tells me that it has to happen, like they it must, but there's something in my heart that tells me it never does. I don't know. But again, it's impossible to, because, like, there's also a chance that, like, Cooper waking up from Dougie Jones is him, like, waking up into, like, a fourth personality. Like, who knows what the fuck is ever going to happen on this show?
Yeah, I think expecting, that is a good point, because expecting that we will see old Dale Cooper, probably... but I don't think it's a certainty.
No, yeah. So I think that counts in the never column. Okay. If, like, he wakes up and it's like, you know, he's like a sentient dog person or something.
No, he's Muad'Dib.
Yes.
From Dune.
It's a Dune crossover. And finally, David Lynch gets to go back to the one mistake in his career and gets to fix it.
Did I say that right? Muad'Dib?
Yes, Muad'Dib. Okay. His name is a killing word.
Okay. I know very little about Dune because I've only seen the movie. And it doesn't tell you a lot about Dune.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, you know, he can, you know, there's that classic scene in line from Dune where he's about to, you know, ride the Shai-Hulud for the first time. And he looks up to the skies of Arrakis and screams, "Father! The sleeper has awakened!" And maybe what he was talking about was Dougie Jones the whole time.
Yes. That would be great. If that's how David Lynch redeems Dune, is he brings it into the Twin Peaks verse.
Yes.
I did think it was interesting that the most response was for within the last five episodes. I think you guys are very optimistic. God bless you.
Yeah.
My vote would be for the finale at this point. Like, if I had to guess, and the finale will be 2 hours, so that's worth thinking.
Sure, yeah.
I think, obviously, all the action is going to converge at Twin Peaks. I think he will wake up, and I think we'll be just in time to... I really do think there's a possibility that this ends with him and Evil Coop going over the falls at the Great Northern... Sherlock Holmes style.
Sure.
And I think that would be a beautifully poetic, a wonderful, weird Lynch ending, is if he just quotes Sherlock Holmes with that big waterfall that is in the opening of every episode of Twin Peaks.
Yes.
You gotta do it.
Yeah.
So that's my working theory. I don't know if it'll happen, but that's as good a theory as I can make with what we have.
Here's another theory for what happens when eventually Dougie Jones and Evil Cooper encounter one another is they accidentally, like, brush up against one another, and then you find out that, like, it's basically matter and antimatter, and they annihilate each other, and the entire planet is destroyed. And that's the end of the show.
I would not take anything off the table.
Yeah.
All right. Should we talk about all the other good stuff in this episode?
Yeah, let's, because we went out of order because there was a significant scene that needed to be addressed. But let's go back through.
All right. There's a lot of stuff to talk about here. We open with a scene on kind of the seedier side of Twin Peaks.
Oh, yeah.
Where we have Richard Horne, who is named diegetically for the first time in this episode.
But I'm only ever going to, because of the actions he commits specifically in this episode, he is now forever Dick Horne to me. Because he's a fucking dick.
I hope that's a line of dialogue at some point. I could see Robert Forster selling that line.
Yeah.
Anyway, we go up to a trailer park, and Richard Horne drives up to see Miriam. Now, that's the woman from the diner a few episodes back who saw him run over the little boy.
Yeah.
And Miriam apparently has already told the police and written a letter to Sheriff Truman saying that if anything happened to her, Richard did it. Miriam's very smart.
Yeah.
Capable. I like that. But Richard
maybe should have left a voicemail.
Maybe should have left a voicemail or gotten a gun or something.
Yeah.
Because Richard, but you know, she couldn't know just how much of a dick Dick Horne is.
Yeah.
Because Dick Horne breaks in, kills her. It all happens off screen. This is one of the more horrifying moments in the Lynch oeuvre, I think. The long shot of the trailer situated among the trees. We got the mountains in the background, and the violence is all off screen on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
That was violent.
Yeah, and then he leaves, and then the camera goes into the trailer, and you see he's like opened up the oven to probably try to cause a gas explosion.
Yeah, and another instance of misogynistic violence in the miniseries so far. There's a lot of violence against women. I'm interested to see if that becomes more thematically kind of ingrained into things.
Right.
We haven't seen a lot of men killed yet. It's mostly been very violent, brutal men killing women.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see why we've already had the think pieces on, you know, the misogynistic violence in Lynch's works and how it's referenced here and stuff. I don't think that's an out-of-line opinion or anything.
Sure.
That might be problematic. I do think that I might have said that after the first 5 or 6 episodes. Episode 8 being the Rosetta Stone for Return of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Episode 8 being the crazy one. the really crazy one, let me be clear.
Yeah.
That one is so much about the birth of, or it's about this explosion and eruption of evil in the American, like, you know, idol, you know, we talked about. And I do think I'm interested to see where more he goes with it, but I don't think it's an accident that Lynch is showing all these really angry, brutal men brutalizing women, because I think it's another one of the symptoms of the American sickness that he is interested in.
I mean, I think it goes back to, like, the spark that of the original Twin Peaks of Laura Palmer, which we see, like, this sort of phantasmal image of her later in this episode. And I do feel like one of the core themes of old Twin Peaks that was, like, kind of obfuscated, that was, like, the core theme of Fire Walk With Me, that is becoming, I think, even more and more a big theme here, is abuse.
Yes.
And abuse, like, largely committed by men against women. But yeah, it is definitely, because there are 3 or 4 scenes in this episode that, like, some of them are like total non sequiturs that are that.
And
but
it is.
I don't think he's just doing it to be like sensationalist or something. Yeah. It definitely feels like he is critically interested in interrogating it.
Yes. And yeah, Lynch is a man. He's traditionally, I think, more comfortable writing for men than women, although I think he's written phenomenal female characters and parts for women and stuff. I think he is interested in this critically. I don't think it's an accident where, like, he has male blinders on.
No.
Is what I would say. Yeah. And again, if it's hard to watch and that sort of thing, I totally understand it, because I think it is very triggering in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 3 or 4 scenes in this episode that were like really hard to watch for me.
Yeah. But I do think it is part of the tapestry of American horrors he is trying to paint here. And again, if we view this as kind of a magnum opus work, it's tying together a lot of themes that go back to things like Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
Where that is a huge theme that is critically engaged with.
Yeah.
And I would like to see more, when I say critical engagement, like the text start to talk about that a little more. But we're also, we got 8 hours left. So
yeah.
I'm not, and again, I think episode 8 was very literally a game changer in how you thematically read this series.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there could be more of that.
Yeah.
There almost certainly will be more of that. That if that is the weirdest episode we get, I'd be a little surprised.
Yeah. I mean, it was episode 8.
Yes. So anyway. One important thing that happens here is Richard calls Chad. We don't know which Chad it is yet, but we learn later it is Douchebag Chad from the police station. And Douchebag Chad is a dirty cop, because he intercepts the letter, and Lucy sees him do it.
Yeah.
Did you read that way too?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think she knows.
So do we think Lucy's going to help bring douchebag Chad down?
I hope so.
I think Robert Forster will be very happy to slap the cuffs on that motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's an interesting scene. In that same trailer park scene, we have a wonderful image of Mr. Harry Dean Stanton sitting outside his house playing guitar and singing, which that needed to be a 5-minute scene, and I'm a little disappointed it was only like 1 minute.
Yeah, like there's another version of this episode, even though I think like the musical performance that ends this episode is like fucking jaw-dropping.
Yes.
I kind of almost wish that like this scene like of him, or like, I mean, they can always go back to it. Like this is not the only time you can have Harry Dean Stanton sitting in a trailer park playing acoustic guitar and singing. So I hope that is the end credits of another episode, is him doing that.
I think it's going to be the end credits of the finale.
Yes.
He's been out of the action, and then it cuts. He has no idea of the insanity that just happened, and he's just playing the guitar.
Until the explosion consumes him.
Yes, sure. Anyway, but we are interrupted by someone throwing a red mug out of the window of this trailer and a voice muttering inside. We go inside and it turns out it's druggy dude, I forget his name, and Amanda Seyfried.
Yeah.
And he is abusing her, as we, I think, could have inferred a little bit from their last appearance. This is only our second appearance of these characters. I think they were in episode 5. Or 6.
It's been a while.
I want to say, I think it was episode 5, because it was the first one after that big 4-hour premiere. And we talked about how great their scenes were there. They seemed more important there than they've wound up being in the interstitial episodes. But now we have them here for a little bit. I do think there's more to come with these characters. Yeah. I'm interested to see what goes with this. Again, I think there is a theme about, you know, whatever the darkness is in, like, Dark Coop, I think it's seeped into other characters, either literally or thematically, in much rougher fashion, and I think that's part of it here. What this felt like to me was a much darker, more extreme take on the Leo Shelley dynamic. Yeah. And in fact, here, even the way it was shot, the way the things coming out of his mouth, it really felt like self-consciously it was asking you to think about the Leo Shelley scenes from the original, which were a very stark portrait of domestic abuse for 1991.
Yeah.
And I think this is an equally stark, but for 25 years later.
Yeah, because it's definitely, like a lot of this language is repeated in the next time Dick Horn comes around later in the episode, of this sort of like, this the language of abuse of trying to like blame it on the victim and like make the victim feel like it is their fault, that somehow they have made some mistake, they've said something wrong, they're wearing something wrong, they looked the wrong way, and they've brought this violence down upon themselves. And that's like the language that he uses.
Yeah, Lynch is very interested in domestic violence.
Yeah.
You know, from Blue Velvet, through Wild at Heart a little bit, Twin Peaks obviously, and the new Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Inland Empire in some places, as much as you can read anything literal onto Inland Empire. But, like, it is, I think, a persistent theme, and I think part of why it strikes a nerve with people is that it's very unvarnished. It's not a romanticized version of any of this, and I think the reality of it comes in what you're saying of that horrible victim-blaming mentality, which is what creates these cycles of violence among victims and perpetrators.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's hard to watch for a reason.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Speaking of domestic violence, although in a slightly different direction, we cut to the house of who we will eventually learn are the Mitchum brothers, played by Jim Belushi, and I don't know the other actor's name, but he's a character actor. You see him in things. And the Mitchum brothers are interesting because we'd seen them a little bit before. They have three young blonde women in pink dresses, like, as their slave.
I don't like Naomi Watts, like very much so.
Yeah, like a younger kinda,
like pulled from Mulholland Drive or something and put into that dress.
Like the ingenue kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's weird. They almost act like automatons or something.
Like the thing I love is that they act like, because there's three of them, and then like one of them is actually like a character that is more of a participant in the
Candy.
Scene. Yeah, Candy. And then two of them are in the background. And it feels like It I don't think this is what they're literally supposed to be, but this like just like the effect it had on me is that they were like they're supposed to just be background characters that like metatextually speaking, these people are only supposed to exist in the background back of a frame to like, you know, because you get later in when you're in the casino office with them and they're all leaning against the back wall, like kind of in this like weird intimidating kind of posture. You've seen like every fucking gang movie, any scene set in the casino, and you're like, oh, they're the special girls that like are like with the boss that get to be in like the meetings where he's gonna beat the guy up or something, and they're like just up against the wall, like completely indifferent, just like leaning there. And it feels like they're supposed to just be that. And so when one of them gets dragged out of that, they don't know how to exist in the world. Like, that's what it kind of weirdly felt like to me.
I think that's a great reading. And, you know, we did see the Mitchum brothers and their three girls, whatever they are,
yeah,
one other time earlier in the series. And I remember there being takes on Twitter and elsewhere of, like, see, this is proof of Lynch's sexism, women as background objects. And that's another one where I was like, I'd wait. We're only 5 hours out of 18.
Yeah.
My guess is Lynch does something with that. And I think he does do something with that in that, yes, that was women as background objects. And I think now it's getting interrogated. And I don't know where it will go. I don't know if we'll go to anything of true worth. But I think per your reading there, yes, you have Candy coming out of the background. And what happens is interesting. And I do, if for no other reason than it is funny to have these men being so befuddled by the background woman taking active agency at things.
Yeah.
And that alone feels interesting and subversive to me. So you have two scenes of that here. The first one here is where you meet the Mitchum brothers in their house, and Candy, we learn her name is Candy later, is flailing a napkin at a fly. And she can't get the fly, so she picks up a remote, and then she just, out of the blue, slaps one of the Mitchums across the face so hard, and then just falls into complete histrionics. Yeah. And it's a hilarious scene.
It's really funny. It's another one of those scenes where it's like, you get those great examples of David Lynch just knowing how to use dead space in a scene to just build up this weird sense of, like, either, like, dread or, like, comedic tension. And it's just, like, when it just snaps and she just hits him just as hard as humanly possible in the face with that fucking remote. I lost my shit. It was hilarious.
It's so funny. And then he holds it long enough to give you time to laugh.
Exactly.
You know? And then we do some cuts, and then when we're back to the big house, you have Candy on the floor crying, and the Mitchum who got hit is like, no, Candy, I'm fine, I'm okay, it's okay. And again, it's like he doesn't know how to react now that Candy is, like, you know, not being a background object.
Yeah.
And then they're watching the news, and I want David Lynch to direct all news broadcasts, because what happens with this one is they're like, let's roll the dice, and they roll the dice, and it lands on local news. And then which is just so fucking weird. And we get the arrest of Ike the Spike. And one of the Mitchums goes, hey, remember to call off that hit on Ike, which is interesting.
He's just like, we're going to save a lot of money, and they do like an air fist bump, which is very good.
Yes. I wrote this later in my notes, but the Mitchum brothers feel like a parody of Quentin Tarantino mobsters.
Yes, yeah.
Like, and Quentin Tarantino mobsters are already a, like, satirical homage of something.
Yeah.
So it's like two layers of like homage and parody, and we get to the Mitchum brothers.
Yeah.
Like, it definitely feels like John Travolta and Michael Madsen would be these characters if it was a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I like it being Jim Belushi and the other guy. Anyway, we then get the footage about Dougie, where we get to hear the wonderful line again, Douglas Jones, he moved like a cobra. Again, if I ever get a tattoo, that's it. You know, just guarantee. And they recognize, they seem to kind of recognize what's going on with Dougie and Janie. And you have Janie's whole speech here, which we mentioned earlier, but it is so funny.
And it's like you get this full, unedited, just long, single take of it, which is really good.
And the best part, my favorite line, what I wrote down is, she goes, and Dougie, he gave him the good old karate chop to the throat. It's just so great. But they, the Mitchums recognize Dougie as Mr. Jackpots. Yeah. Turns out our Mr. Jones is actually Mr. Jones. What a fucking world. That is a great exchange. Anyway, all right. What else to talk about with all that? Because we do have another scene later on with the Mitchums, don't we?
Yes, because that's where the guy has to, they have to get the guy to the room and Candy has to go out and help him.
Yes. Okay, so yeah, we have two scenes here. We have one back at the Spear in Las Vegas, and the guy who put out, the pit boss who put out the hit on Dougie, hears that Ike was arrested. So he calls over Anthony, who he calls a creative individual. And he says, do you recall my business rivals and business enemies, the Mitchum brothers? So he wants to frame something on Dougie, so we have that whole thing. I like that we are seemingly setting up a Roadrunner scenario where various Vegas crime lords are all going to come after Dougie, and they're all going to fail, I imagine, because I don't think you're going to kill Kyle MacLachlan on Twin Peaks.
I'm just looking forward to him just karate chopping more people in the neck.
I know. And then Janie's, you know, monologues about it.
Yeah.
But yes, at the Silver Mustang Casino, the Mitchums, that's their casino, and Anthony comes in. They're watching security footage, and they see that Anthony is here. So they tell Candy to go get Anthony. And
bring
the whole,
back to the room.
Yes. It's completely like an expository scene. And what it is Lynch being playful with Candy because she's being completely uncooperative in the most beautifully Lynchian way. You want me to get him? and bring him here? Like, she just doesn't get it. Finally, she leaves and goes to get it. And she starts miming directions, and then she just starts talking to him about all these things. And finally, one of the midshipmen breaks and yells, "What the fucking fuck?" Or something like that.
This is just a long shot of, yep, like, you just looking at this fucking security camera footage and her just pantomiming all this crazy shit, and you have no idea what's happening.
One of the Mitchums looks at the other and is like, "We gotta get rid of her." And the other guy says, "We fire her. She's got no place to go." And I think there's been a lot of theories on the internet about what these three women are. Like, yeah, are they also like Dougie Jones, kind of like projections from the Red Room? Which, who knows, could, yeah, be.
Sure.
I just think it's funny. Candy does come in. She goes, "Here he is." Curtsies and then goes back to the wall. And they ask, "What were you two talking about?" That we're in the version layer, that it's going to be hot and smoggy tomorrow. And I told him we are so lucky to have air conditioning cooling our casino. I love Candy. She's my, yeah, new hero. She's great. Anyway, but the dude does do his job and tells Mr. Mitchum and Mr. Mitchum, he addresses them both as Mr. Mitchum, that Dougie Jones, the insurance agent, had set up this whole thing with the burning down of the casino, and that's why they're not getting their money. And so, there's this whole really funny part where he goes, "You have an enemy in Douglas Jones." It's great. And then we do finally get, they decide that they do want to kill Douglas Jones. There's the great line where one of them says, "Now I know how Brando felt." It's getting back another Marlon Brando reference, yeah, for us. And here we get the great line. "He took us $30,447,000. Motherfucker, you fuck us once, shame on us. You fuck us twice, shame on you. You're dead."
Yeah.
That's a great line of dialogue. So, all right. We got all that with the Mitchum brothers. Anything else more to say about the Mitchum brothers?
No, I'm excited to see where that goes.
Yes.
Spike version 2.
Indeed. I just, again, the Roadrunner scenario with a bunch of assassins sounds fun. So
maybe Candy's the assassin. Who knows?
Oh, that'd be great. And then Douglas Jones just puts the charm on her.
Or karate chops her in the neck. Or maybe that's the same thing. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Anyway, in the middle of this episode, we get another broadcast from Dr. Jacoby.
Yes,
remember that?
Yeah.
This one was even better. "We grow our wool, and just when we're getting warm, they come with their electric razors and shear our wool off." And he goes on for like another minute about wool and was talking too fast for me to get any of this down. But it's great. You still have Nadine watching. Yeah. And the best detail is she has a store now called Run Silent, Run Drapes, where she has a gold shovel displayed, yep, proudly in the window. That's wonderful.
Yep.
If that's all we see of Nadine, I love that she has become a entrepreneur of silent drapes.
She's finally become the woman she wanted to be.
Yep. At the end of the scene, she looks in there and says, "He's so beautiful." Maybe there'll be a romance between Dr. Jacoby and Nadine.
Yeah. We haven't seen Big Ed yet, so.
We have not. Yes. We did get another entry in the Adventures of Jerry Horn.
Uh-huh, very briefly.
Very briefly. He's lost in the woods, looks at his phone, and goes, "You can't fool me! I've been here before!" So.
No, he's moved on from fighting his own foot. Yes. So I think he's improving.
Maybe where this will intersect is whatever Bobby and Sheriff Truman are going to do. They will find Jerry in the woods.
Jesus.
I think that would be funny.
Maybe that's why he's just lost in the woods, as he stumbled into some Red Room style, like, you know, Bermuda Triangle. No matter where he goes, he keeps on coming back to the same spot thing.
Maybe the end of the Red Room story is that Jerry winds up in the Red Room and becomes the new attendant, like Mike.
Yes.
Anyway.
The man from another place turned into a brain on a tree, so someone's got to, like, fill in that role, huh?
Yep. All right, let's talk about a less fun scene at the Horn House.
Yeah, Dick's yes, unfortunate return.
So we do see Johnny Horn, and we do see Grandma Horn.
Yeah, so that sort of clarifies that scene from last episode where Johnny runs into the wall. That is definitely the same Johnny.
And Grandma Horn, I had to look it up. Her name's Sylvia Horn. We didn't get a ton of her in the original series.
No, there's only a couple of scenes. They sort of abandoned that character early on.
Yeah, and we do learn in a later scene, it seems like she and Ben are divorced.
Yeah.
And all this stuff. But anyway, she lives there with Johnny. I think this scene very conspicuously does not have Audrey in it. And I feel like we're definitely building to Audrey having a big role, because something's happened with all that.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm interested to see where that goes. But yeah, Sylvia is there. Richard pulls up. And Grandma, as he says, does not want to see him. She is very scared of this guy. Does not want him there. Tells him to get out. And he beats the shit out of her. Yeah. And that is a dark-ass scene. He's using a lot of very pointed misogynistic language at her, bitch and things like that, wants the combination to the safe. And throughout this scene, Johnny Horn is looking at a teddy bear with a light bulb head.
Yeah.
And it's saying, okay, what's the exact line? Hello, Johnny, how are you today? Over and over, and that's pretty much the soundtrack to the scene.
Yeah.
It's over and over, hello, Johnny, how are you today? And poor Johnny Horn is lying on the floor all tied up because apparently that's how they take care of him, which is a little weird, but...
I mean, he did just, like, almost kill himself by running into a wall the previous
day. Yeah, so. I'm just saying, you think with their money you'd get, like, a professional to, like, figure out his issues sure. and help him out. I don't think that's actually how you take care of people with mental issues, but in Lynch's world, maybe you do. Yes, but anyway, yeah, Richard goes through the safe, he steals all this shit, he calls his grandma a cunt, it's very unpleasant... And very unnerving, and that is a disturbing ass scene.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, you know, that's like third of those scenes in this episode. So it is definitely, it's a running
theme here.
Running theme.
You know, there's the theory, obviously, that Richard is evil Coop's even more violent son, that he might have raped Audrey in the hospital. And that seems to hold weight for me here, because he is purely misogynistic, purely evil. He is all the things that you would expect Cooper and Audrey's baby not to be, if it was real Cooper. Like, real Dale Cooper's son would be, like, the most gentlemanly boy out there, right?
Yes.
He'd be a good kid.
Yeah.
This kid is not a good kid. And I do think this idea of, like, the literal and metaphoric sons of evil Coop, of Bob, out in the world, is a scary and interesting theme here. That, like, you know, them catching Leland Palmer in Twin Peaks and kind of seeing where Bob is in the Red Room and all that, that didn't solve the problem.
Right.
That evil spirit, whatever it is, has infected the world even more than it did 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Which I think is both a literal plot mechanic going on here and a thematic thing that Lynch is talking about in the series.
Yes.
So, anyway, that was scary. I hope Richard Horn gets a good comeuppance at some point.
Yep.
Anyway, let's see. We have a wonderful scene with Gordon Cole in a hotel room.
Oh, yeah.
And Gordon Cole has got a glass of wine, and he's drawing with a Sharpie. And I wrote, this could just be footage of David Lynch hanging out on the set doodling. Who knows? And I do love that we zoom in on his picture, and it is a very Lynchian drawing. If you've seen his paintings and stuff, that's what it all looks like. So I liked that they kind of worked that into the show. But Cole answers the door, and this is where we get what you mentioned, that specter image of Laura crying, I think from Firewalk with Me. It's from the scene, I think, where Leland opens her door or something.
Yeah, I think so.
But it actually winds up being Albert. Cole is shaken. What do you make of that scene?
It's just, it's something, because it's happened a couple of times where, like, Laura Palmer, I think, like, the biggest one I can think of off the top of my head is back with Bobby, when Bobby walked into the room when they were doing all the evidence stuff and saw her there, and, like, the theme starts playing and he just breaks down. That it's just this reminder of, again, or, like, you know, going back to episode 8 and that, like, the weird, like, the symbol of Laura Palmer being sent down to Earth as, like, a messianic or, like, Jesus Christ kind of thing. So it is just, it feels like it's this reminder of that all this, for us, and for, as, like, viewers of Twin Peaks, like, all this started from that place of Laura Palmer, of, like, this mystery of this girl who seemed like she had everything in the world, but was actually this, like, victim of incest and abuse, and then ultimately of murder.
It's, in the diegesis of the show, it's like the original sin.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
It's... And I do think for an episode that focuses so much on all the different pieces of misogynistic violence that are going to have to be confronted, having that specter of Laura Palmer feels appropriate. And, you know, I think it's also worth remembering every episode of New Twin Peaks has the specter of Laura Palmer, because her picture is at the beginning of every theme song. And it always makes me remember, like, right, this is not about the Laura Palmer murder, but that does hang over it for good reason.
Yes.
You know? So that's interesting.
It's also just, like, a really startling moment. Yes. Like I it's unnerving. And almost, like, a way that felt like... It's unnerving in similar ways to the scene in Mulholland Drive where, like, the garbage man comes out of the corner. Like, it doesn't seem like it should have the kind of impact it has on you, but, like, it really kind of left me shaken in a weird way.
Yeah. The next scene, though, we have Albert, you know, come in, tells Cole to turn up the dial on his hearing aids, as they've done before. He says that they learned that Diane received that text from Evil Cooper, or who they assume is Evil Cooper. The around the dinner table, the conversation is lively. Pinged off a cell tower in Philly, Albert says. They thought it might have been one of her boyfriends, but then they traced it to a server in Mexico, which is where we know Evil Coop has his, you know.
So that shoots down my theory that it was that, like, one guy that was living at her house, and it was just a total coincidence.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so Diane sent a response. They have Hastings. He's going to take them to the site. And as Albert says, doesn't sound like boyfriend talk. And Cole says, I felt it when she hugged me, but this confirms it. Keep her close. So that's interesting. They're working on Diane. I think this is a plot thread that's interesting because this could lead them back to Evil Cooper.
Yeah.
And see where that goes.
Yeah. And I like that the turnaround on that was really quick. I like that we didn't have to wait like 3 episodes to see what came of that text message.
Absolutely. Then Agent Tammy Baldwin comes in and mentions the penthouse murders in New York, which we have not heard about since the premiere.
Yeah.
And we have this picture, and it's an image of Evil Cooper. I think he's sitting in the box, facing like a scientist dude. And as Cole says, damn, this is something. This is really something. And I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of startling to see the box again, to see Evil Cooper in there. I kind of thought the box might have been something we weren't going to get back to.
Yeah.
So that was
that maybe it was just like the box was more suggestive of like this, like the dimensional stuff. You know, transferring me to our world or however the fuck you want to read that shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems like maybe that is going to be something that comes back in a more direct fashion.
Between that and the hints we've had about Evil Cooper looking for ways to escape the Red Room and the coordinates he's looking for, it feels like Evil Cooper has some kind of like Lovecraftian plan to unleash a horror on this world, you know? To unleash Cthulhu, basically.
Mm-hmm. I would not put it past the show if that's how it basically ended up. You know, Cthulhu is part of the public domain. They could actually literally use Cthulhu.
I've said this. I think it is a real possibility that Twin Peaks, The Return, has an anime ending where they have to fight a god.
Mm-hmm.
That is not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
Just, you know, keep that in mind. We do have a scene at the Great Northern with Ben Horn, who's on the phone with Sylvia. Hears about the incident with Richard. She's very mad at him. Seems they're divorced. And Ben, after hanging his head, calls for Beverly and sees if she wants to have dinner with him. Very nice scene as played by Richard Boehmer, I thought.
Yeah.
And I liked kind of that he's been resisting Beverly, and now he's like maybe going to go into this affair with her. It's a small recurring thread, but they've been good scenes.
Yeah, because they definitely, like the past couple of episodes, have kept on checking in on him, so it feels like that's going to go somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, Richard Boehmer, obviously, he's aged 25 years, and he looks older. His voice has not changed.
Yeah.
He's a singer. He was a Broadway star. Like, that makes sense, but like, it's just, he totally feels like the actor he was 25 years ago, and that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Even if he does, as people have pointed out, look like David Letterman.
You know, that's just part of the deal.
That's just part of the deal. All right. We have something I was very surprised by. The last sort of main scene in this episode is a log lady scene.
Yeah.
Where she's on the phone with Hawk. And I want to read this because I thought her monologue here, you could put this as, like, to me, the thesis of, like, the whole series put into words.
Yeah.
She says, Hawk, electricity is humming. You hear it in the mountains and rivers. You see it dance among the seas and stars and glowing around the moon. But in these days, the glow is dying. What will be in the darkness that remains? The Truman brothers are both true men. They are your brothers. And the others, the good ones, who have been with you, now the circle is almost complete. Watch and listen to the dream of time and space. It all comes out now, flowing like a river. That which is and is not. Hawk, Laura is the one. There's been a lot of writing for the Log Lady over the life of the series, including the little Log Lady intros. Have you ever seen those?
Yeah, they're on your DVD box set.
And they're fun. That, to me, is far and away the best piece of writing given to the Log Lady. I think it's one of the most beautiful things David Lynch has ever written. And God bless Catherine Coulson.
Yeah.
She was phenomenal in that scene. And again, you know, got the oxygen in. We knew she was close to death when she filmed this. Really powerful scene to me.
Yeah, the line, the glow is dying, in particular, felt like that captured something about that, like, Lynchian, and particularly, like, this series of Twin Peaks, the return of, like, this sense of, like, almost entropy or decay of just, like, things are dying out and just kind of getting worse and unpleasant, and like, coupled with, like, what we've talked about, like, these three, like, really intense, and, like, progressively, I think, kind of, like, more intense scenes of direct, like, abuse, and that just, there's something about that line that so simply captures that feeling of the glow is dying.
It's poetry. It's just, it's a beautiful, you know, free verse poem, and I love it. And I like that the Hawk is still on the phone with the Log Lady every now and then, getting advice. Beautiful. The last scene of the episode, though, is we cut to the Roadhouse, and another band performance. This one, more than any we've had so far, reminded me of like a traditional Lynchian like music scene. Mm-hmm. This really reminded me of the Julie Cruz stuff in the original Twin Peaks and in Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And it just, it's this playing out at full hypnotic length. And
they play the entire song.
They do the entire song. It's much longer before they get to the credits than they usually do with this. Like, clearly Lynch loved this one, and rightfully so. And what's interesting to me about how it's used here is that in Blue Velvet, or in the original Twin Peaks, or in Mulholland Drive, when you have these moments of the characters singing, it's usually done from a POV of a particular character or set of characters, and it's a huge moment of emotional awakening. Yeah. One you might think of in the original Twin Peaks is the scene where Maddie Palmer has been murdered by Leland. Spoiler, I'm kidding. I think we're all on the same page. And they're at the Roadhouse, and Cooper has that vision. But the song continues, and you have, like, Bobby break down crying. And I think Shelley is there, and she breaks down, and everyone gets super emotional. Or Mulholland Drive has one like this right before the movie shifts. Not to spoil. I don't know how I would else I would describe
There's
that.
There's no way to... You cannot spoil Mulholland Drive. No, that is a futile process.
Indeed. But yeah, so in those scenes, you have this POV thing. But here, in this series, I don't think they're singing out to any particular character. It's like to the larger tapestry of the series as a whole. And it's still incredibly moving, because a song like this, I didn't, you know, go in and analyze the lyrics too much, but atmospherically, emotionally, just tonally for the music, it felt like such a perfect emotional summation of this hour and everything that happened in it. And again, singing out into the universe, not because there's also very few audience shots in the performances at the Roadhouse this time, because the audience is us. It's the person who has taken in this holistic view of the Twin Peaks universe. And I thought this was, as you said earlier, incredibly powerful.
Yeah, like the song is called, and like the chorus line is "No Stars," which in particular for us is like a pretty significant gut punch, because we had that episode of Doctor Who with Peter Capaldi where he's lying on the ground and this is his. No stars. I always hoped there would be stars. And you don't, like, there's something about, obviously, that's
a complete coincidence.
That's only going to hit with people like us that are big fans of both shows. But, like, there is something about that sentiment of there being no stars. And, like, it's a very poetic and, like, expressive way of sort of symbolizing, like, the glow is dying. Like, hope is gone. There's no future. There's no beyond. There's no, like, something else out there that is calling to you, because they have twinkled out and the stars are gone and there are no stars anymore. And that, like, it's a really haunting, beautiful performance. I liked it a lot.
Yeah. This, I thought, as an episode, like, as a relatively normal episode of Twin Peaks The Return, not like an episode 3 or 8.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. I think it was very, it jumped around to a lot of places, but I think with an incredible amount of focus. It had some very fun stuff. It also, I think, had a very interesting through line of darkness down to the last scene with the log lady and then this performance. This one left me pretty floored.
Yeah, it's just one of those things of what we've been talking about. This show has such an impressive ability to both be telling this like really intricate serialized story, but then also making sure the episodes feel contained and thematically coherent and singular. And it's something that, like, it's been a running theme, I think, on this podcast of us when we talk about different shows, that talking about how important that is, I think, if you're doing something that is episodic, of whether it's, you know, Daredevil on Netflix, or it's Hannibal, or it's, you know, anime something, or it's Doctor Who, or it's Twin Peaks, your episode should be in some way a self-contained storytelling unit, even if, you know, in like the more specific elements, you need the broader context of everything else around it to really understand the episode. There should be some sort of heart or soul of it, that of some idea, some thesis that this episode is expressing. And I feel like every single episode of Twin Peaks: The Return has been like that. And you can see that in our discussions of this episode of how abuse is thematized. And it's obviously thematized in larger ways in the whole series, but this episode in and of itself has something to say about that, and concluding with the song "No Stars."
It's
an example of that.
I have not, you know, we've been through several Sundays now of watching Twin Peaks, and I have not ever gotten to the end of Sunday night and felt impatient for more Twin Peaks, because we've gotten at least 1 hour of such a significant slice of art that I have wanted to chew on it and think on it, and I would never be in a rush to just go watch the next episode. And that's pretty rare, even with shows I absolutely love and think do a great job with the episodic stuff. Oftentimes, you know, Doctor Who's a great example. At the end of one, I'm champing at the bit. I want to see the next one.
Uh-huh.
This is like, I'm so satisfied in this hour of television, I'm okay waiting a week, because frankly, a week is a good amount of time to chew on this.
Yeah, you just need to let it sort of percolate in your system and figure it out.
Percolate,
you
know? good yes. choice of words for Twin Peaks.
It's it's just something we have to at least say every time we talk about it. It's like the best fucking show on television right now.
Oh, well,
one of
easily
the best shows
yeah.
ever. And you know, this is it's just like if there is one fucking thing that other TV shows should look at what Twin Peaks is doing and figure out how to do it, I think it is this. I think it is the way that Twin Peaks The Return manages to create thematically coherent, driven episodes that conclude their own thematic arc within themselves while contributing to the greater whole. And that is the thing that I think is the most difficult thing about writing episodic stories, yeah. and most especially, TV shows really need to get that shit figured out.
Especially multi-location ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're focused enough, that can be less of a problem.
Yeah, but if you have like, all these subplots going on, that you're there's this tendency of just like the episode feeling like it's this big sprawling like dump of different plot lines that eventually will come together maybe to something satisfying after like episode 12, but in that moment it is not.
Game of Thrones traditionally has had this problem. I will say the season 7 premiere, which was this weekend, was one of the better episodes of Game of Thrones in terms of, I think, having focus in the cuts and telling something of a thematic story over that hour, and I was very impressed by that. But it is something in the past Game of Thrones sometimes struggles with, and it's been a counterpoint because Game of Thrones, like Twin Peaks, has a bunch of characters and a bunch of locations, and other than that, it's not much like Twin Peaks.
Right.
Anyway.
You don't have, like, the one episode that is just an avant-garde movie where it's just, like, zooming into the nuclear explosion.
Yeah. You know, Game of Thrones and Twin Peaks are airing at the same time now. And yeah. I've decided to watch Game of Thrones first because I think it would be unfair to poor Game of Thrones to watch it after Twin Peaks.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why every time I watch an episode of Twin Peaks, it's like the last thing I basically do before I go to bed because it's like you can't do anything after it. Like, you just have to go and lie in bed for like 30 minutes staring at the ceiling, processing it, and then you can go to sleep. Like, I couldn't play a game or like watch another TV show or a movie after watching an episode of one of these Twin Peaks.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but anyway, it is fun. I think what the funniest thing to me about this is Game of Thrones started airing its new season on episode 10 of Twin Peaks. And it, partially because Game of Thrones is having a shorter season this year, Twin Peaks will still be on when Game of Thrones is done.
Yeah.
That's how long this fucking season is.
I mean, because that's one of the craziest things about it is that it's not just like this really strong, brilliant, episodic, thematically driven show, but it's even longer than those shows typically are. Like, those shows typically are like 8, 10, 12 episodes long. You know, they which helps them be able to be that focused. Whereas like Twin Peaks is like, fuck that shit. We're 18 episodes. No show is 18 episodes long. Like the like one weird truncated season of the X-Files is like 18 episodes long. Yeah. No normal TV show is 18 episodes.
Yeah, you either go 22 or 10, you know, these days. Yeah. So it's fun. God bless Showtime. As I said on Twitter, I really hope this is successful enough that Showtime greenlights David Lynch Presents, where he just does like half-hour avant-garde films, and he does an Alfred Hitchcock-style opening to each of them where he talks about it.
Yeah, and all of them star either Naomi Watts or Kyle MacLachlan or both. Or Laura Dern.
Or Laura Dern. Yeah, you know, we can mix them up. Yeah, it's going to be great.
Just like a rolling cast.
Yes. Or that guy who played the scary homeless man in episode 8.
Sure, yeah.
He could be in there as the evil doer.
Yes, the further adventures of Mr. God of Light.
All right, we will be back next week. It will be our 199th episode.
Fuck.
And yes, I do have a minor heart palpitation every time I write the episode number we're on now.
That's so many. That's so many episodes. Man, Jonathan, this podcast has been a lot of things, but the fact that we've gotten this far sure is peculiar.